Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 419. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. But more importantly, we have returning after a two-week hiatus, Mr. John Lindemann.
A new streak is beginning tonight.
We're not wearing any clothes.
We miss you, buddy. It's so good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
You have a game to talk about that I think everybody is curious to hear what you think about it.
Yep.
But of course, we also have Mr. James Jones.
Yep.
And Guillaume Veillette.
I apologize in advance for any inappropriate mouth noises tonight.
Well, we decided to push off the retroactive discussion until next week because a couple of these guys need more time to play it. And it'll give me a chance to get deeper into it, although I feel like I'm kind of up to speed on it, but it never hurts to put in a little extra time. So we're going to do that next week. So that means if you're listening to this close to when it comes out, you probably still have a chance to get some comments in the forum thread. So if you've been playing along and you haven't done that yet, this is probably your last chance, really. It's only going to be a few days between when this show comes out and when we record that feature. So if you want to be a part of it, if you want to have your comment read on the show and join that discussion for the podcast feature, now is the time to do it. Don't delay. But we're definitely looking forward to that. I think Pokemon the Trading Card Game ended up being a pretty interesting choice. I think we'll have a lot to say. I know quite a few people have been playing along with us, so I'm excited to get into that. But that does mean we have time for listener mail this week, including some topics that we've been waiting for a while to get to and some other really fun stuff we're going to get into. But first off is new business. And Guillaume, I thought maybe you could start because you have a brand new Wii game to talk about.
Yes, I do. I got Kirby and the Rainbow Curse, which is, as most listeners know, the kind of sequel to the DS game Kirby and the Canvas Curse. This game seems to be dividing the game reviewing community and many Nintendo fans. I think the game is, well, you know, as you could expect from a Kirby game, the game is really charming and it's just crazy to look at, and it's kind of insane to look at, like, on Twitter back when it came out, like seeing grown men just go
cry
basically crying in front of the cuteness that is this game and the clay art style and just
well, because it is so divisive, Guy, which side do you fall on? Are you pro Rainbow Curse or anti?
It's a good game. Like, lots of people are saying, oh, well, this is a great game, but it's on the wrong console. I would prefer to play it on the 3DS because on the Wii U, you can basically only play with a gamepad, right? Like, if you're the first player or the only player, this is a co-op game, but like, if you're in single player, you can only play by drawing lines on the playing field. And, that's how you move Kirby around. You draw a line under him and you touch him to make him, dash, and, you draw basically the path that he's gonna go on, and you try to collect everything and try to kill the enemies. So yeah, that's the only method of control here. Just a stylus and you draw those lines. And the problem is that the game looks gorgeous on a TV, and there's lots of little details. Like, you can see, like, the kind of, like, misshapen balls of clay or something. Like, you can see the imperfections, and it's perfectly rendered on the TV screen. But then when you're looking down at your gamepad, all those details are lost because the gamepad's resolution is not good enough. And it's just, everything is just a little bit blurrier and really takes away from the effect, you know?
It's just not a good screen.
I mean, right. No.
You know, it's not that it's not large enough or that even the, I don't even think it's a resolution problem. I think the quality of the screen is just poor.
Right. So that's a big shame. And that's part of the reason why some people are saying, oh, I would prefer to play this on 3DS. But then I don't really get that, because then you would, well, I guess you wouldn't know what you have lost, but you definitely wouldn't see more details on a 3DS screen.
No.
And so that's one issue that some people have. And I think the way that I'm playing it, co-op, it kind of solves it, because other players can grab a sideways Wii remote and control a Waddle Dee, and the controls are normal, you know, like you just control with the D-pad and the A button to attack and B button to jump, and it plays like basically a Kirby game. And so that alleviates, well, first, If you just like switch roles back and forth, you know, like every stage or so, then both players get to appreciate the quality of the graphics. So that's one. And two, one of the complaints that I've heard is that the stage is going for too long and that you just don't feel like going back to collect everything. Well, when you've got more than one player, that just means that you're going to have to do that less. Like, you're not going to have to fuss around as much trying to collect everything. Like, you're going to have another player with quote unquote, better controls to just go grab those stars for you or that chest or whatever. And because there's two of you and you can concentrate on collecting, you know, each, you know, on your side of the screen, like everything just goes a little bit faster. You know, you can kill enemies faster, you can collect everything faster, you get through the stages faster. So the stages haven't felt that long to me. And there's the fact that I've been playing also co-op Chariot, and that game has long levels. That game takes forever to, like, you sit down and you're like, okay, we're going to play through one level, and 45 minutes later, you finish it, and you're like, well, you know, I don't think we have time to play another one. Kirby, at least, like, we've been going through maybe, like, 3-4 levels a night, you know, like, going through a world per evening. So, it's not so bad.
Okay. Yeah. I was really planning on getting this, and then when all the buzz came out, all the reviews started hitting, I kind of reconsidered it, and I definitely want to play it. I mean, I love Canvas Curse. But it is a different situation, and you know, it's been 10 years. I guess other than the fact that right now I don't really have anyone to swap out with me, maybe I will in the future, and then I'll definitely go back. Or, you know, if I'm going to have somebody visiting for the weekend, and I think this might be something that they'd want to play through with me over the course of a few days, maybe then I'll download it right before they get here. But I don't know that this is something I want to play through just by myself the way I might normally. Mm-hmm. Or I would definitely consider buying it if Nintendo releases an upgraded gamepad with a better screen, which, you know, I've predicted a couple times, and I don't know that it'll actually happen, but maybe it's certainly a possibility. And in that case, I think this would be a lot easier to recommend. But my other concern, I wonder if you could address it, Guy, is that I've heard some people say that the levels aren't that interesting. The level designs just aren't very creative. The game feels in some ways kind of dumbed down even from Canvas Curse because you no longer absorb powers from enemies and there's just not as much variety in the mechanics of what you're doing, drawing these lines all over the place.
I think there's some validity to that. I haven't really seen that much variety, although as you get further and further in the game, the levels definitely become more and more frustrating. So that's probably not the answer that you're looking for. But yeah, there's a lot of just like, okay, collect everything here and then you move on and collect everything there and dispatch these enemies. And you're basically always doing the same kind of thing. But eventually there are a few levels that add, you know, that mix it up a little bit, because Kirby does have transformations. And, so like in some stages, you can become a submarine. And, so Kirby automatically just keeps firing torpedoes in front of him. And you have to use the lines not to control Kirby, but to, kind of, deviate the torpedoes where you want them to go. And so you'll have to send them on switches that otherwise you couldn't, you know, hit. And you have to send them on enemies behind you. Like, you just do a loop with the stylus and you shoot, and, you know, the torpedoes will just slide along your line and are going to, you know, go behind you and dispatch those enemies. So, you know, there's some variety in that. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess maybe I haven't seen enough of the game still to say definitely, well, you know, if it's varied or not. But the thing is, though, I haven't played Kirby's Canvas Curse in a decade, and I just don't remember exactly, you know, if it really was as good as I remember it to be. You know, the fact that I sold it kind of tells me that maybe once I was done with it, I was like, well, you know, I'm never going to go back to this. Like, I'm not over in the moon with this game. So,
yeah, I mean, if I recall, it didn't have a heck of a lot of replay value, I don't think.
No, it didn't. But it was, so fresh. I mean, it was.
Oh, it was really.
It was
cool.
Really the. It was the first like full length, fully fleshed out game idea for the touchscreen. It wasn't just a bunch of. There were a bunch of mini games up to that point on the DS that used the touchscreen, but there wasn't really like a full length adventure game. This was before Phantom Hourglass. Remember, I mean, this kind of thing just didn't exist on the DS for the first 6 or 9 months. And when Canvas Curse came out, it was finally like, you know, it was like all these hardcore Nintendo fans who wanted these meaty games you can really sink your teeth into. And I mean, that was the summer of the DS in 2005, because we also got Meteos and we also got that Castlevania game.
Yep.
And, you know, Castlevania didn't use the touchscreen very well, but it was at least a great game and, you know, lengthy, and you could sink your teeth into it. Meteos, I thought, was a really nice use of touchscreen.
And, I mean, amazingly enough, an actual good Sonic game. Amazingly enough. Sonic Rush.
Right.
Sonic
Rush. But Kirby's Canvas Curse was, in a way, people were waiting for a game that justified the DS. The DS, it's two screens and the touch screen. And, Nintendogs had come out and Brain Age was a thing, but, people didn't see those as quote unquote real games. Like, they wanted a hardcore, more traditional game.
I don't think Brain Age was out yet.
Oh, really?
That came later. Yeah.
Anyway, like, I think that any kind of weird experiment, like Yoshi's Touch and Go, I think, I'm thinking of the other one, whatever it was called, the one where you draw clouds and blow them away, or Peck Picks and stuff like that. Like, sure, they were interesting, but that's not what people were looking for, right? They wanted a quote-unquote traditional game that was, you know, using the touchscreen in a new way. And Kirby's Canvas Curse was it. Today, Rainbow Curse doesn't represent that, right? It's just another game, and we've seen games that use a touchscreen as their primary input, and so there's not that novelty anymore.
Right.
But that doesn't make it a bad game. It just means that maybe the shine is gone.
Maybe the
a
predecessor
bit.
Wasn't as good as you remember.
To me, the. I think Canvas Curse was a really fantastic game. I don't think it's worth our time to try to go back and diminish that. I just think it was incredibly innovative, and that aspect of it is not going to stand up as well to, you know, looking back on it 10 years later, because a lot of things influenced by it, have come out since then. A lot of other games have done things similarly. But I guess, you know, there's no way that Rainbow Curse could have repeated the sort of revolution of Canvas Curse and just how amazing it was at the time. But I feel like, you know, it is kind of just another Canvas Curse, except now on your console. And the fact that you do, you know, on the DS, there wasn't this TV that was mirroring the image at a much higher resolution. Now that there is, I can understand why people are annoyed by that, because they're like, this game looks amazing. I want to look at it in all its glory, and I really can't while I play it. But I feel like the co-op is the way to do it. I think your solution is absolutely the right way to play this game, even though Nintendo maybe never came out and said that. But the way that they've implemented co-op doesn't seem all that interesting to me. And I think this was probably a missed opportunity, maybe it was, to really develop a really, really interesting asymmetric co-op game where you have the person on the touchscreen doing all this stuff with Kirby that's really kind of intricate and difficult and very involved, and then have stuff, you know, people doing things on the TV screen with controllers that's also interesting and involved and, you know, challenging, and then force you to work together. Whereas instead, the co-op stuff on the TV is really totally optional. It also, I've heard that it's like makes the game really easy. It lets you kind of just bypass a lot of the challenges that you would have to do if you're playing just with Kirby. It makes a lot of the bosses super easy, because you can just have – I've seen people in multiplayer. I saw Scott Thompson streaming it last weekend, and they fought the Wispy Woods, which I guess is the first boss. And the co-op players just ran right up to the tree and just bashed him the entire time. So Kirby's over there trying to reflect apples back at him and whatnot, you know, doing all this really tricky stuff to try to beat the boss the correct way. And then all the helpers are just getting up in his face and just like spearing him until he dies. Cause the boss isn't really equipped to deal with those guys down there. He's designed to give Kirby a challenge, not these little dudes who can just walk right up to him.
Yeah, but
so
okay,
that's concerns me. I feel like they could have designed something that's actually cooperative, you know, that has players both do things of equal skill, but different because of different input devices. That would be a Wii U revolution. That's the kind of that would justify the gamepad to me in the way that Canvas Curse justified the touchscreen on the DS.
Okay, but like let's get real for a second here, okay?
Let's get real for a second here about Kirby.
Okay, we're talking about a bunch.
There's your episode title. Let's get real
this
about
is where
Kirby.
This is where we stop being polite and start getting Kirby.
We are talking about, you know, like grown men playing, you know, like in their 30s who have been playing Nintendo games for several decades, and you know, a game where you're controlling a pink ball of clay. Okay. I think, sure, there's, you know, an imbalance here if you're playing with like people all equally skilled, highly skilled at this type of game. But if you're playing with a younger player, which is probably the way that it's meant to be played, then being the helper or having, you know, the baby hold the, be the helper can be really good, you know?
We're so glad you bit on that.
So, I don't know. Like, it's just, I think it's really made for, you know, inexperienced players and
I agree.
More experienced
You're totally
players.
Right. But the sad part of this is it just makes it sound like it's not made for me and my friends who might play this with me. And that's just—it's disappointing, personally.
Sure, but you could be the experienced player in the duo that gets to play this game. Like, I mean,
no,
like
I don't,
bring
but pump. No, but if the other people playing are only going to make the game piss easy, then I don't want them to play with me.
Right,
that's my point.
So here's the problem. This is a problem regardless of who the target audience for this game is. When you were a child, you did not want games to be piss easy. You wanted some degree of
challenge.
But
the game is not piss easy, though. Like I have been like as early as like the third or fourth world.
The support character can't die. He gets knocked out and gets to come right back. Just gets to hammer away at the enemy, and the enemy's not really that interested. The support character. Ultimately, the support character is kind of piss easy. It's kind of like the Tingle Tuner who can attack constantly.
Right. I think that there is some. First, there's a significant delay before the helper can come back, and Kirby can get in a lot of trouble in the meantime. The healing items are not all that plentiful. Like, there are times when you can die.
My point is, playing as the support character is probably not a very fulfilling experience.
It is, though. And like, there is cooperation going on here, and as early as the third or fourth world, there's, like, you're in the sky. And
as early as the third or fourth world.
The worlds are basically three levels long. So it's really early in the game.
Jesus.
But anyway, so like you're in the sky, there's not really that much footing anywhere. So the player who's on the gamepad has to create these lines for both the helper to stand on and for Kirby to, you know, to stay on and to move around.
But again, the helper's experience here is marginal at best. It seems to me that...
Well, do you say that, James? Guillaume has played as the helper, so he's not just
like
conjecturing
here. Yeah, and the thing is, it can be really challenging for both people, because you're trying to do your own thing as the helper, and sometimes, like, you got to predict, okay, Kirby is over there, and, you know, like, I must not be behind or, you know, over there, because otherwise, at some point, there's a lawn that's going to get drawn in my face, and I'm not going to be able to move, and I'm just going to die, right? Like, you have to be really wary of the person who's playing Kirby. And also, like, I don't know, like, in that level where you just don't have a lot of footing, like, the helper is going to have an advantage fighting the enemies, sure. But the fact is, it's kind of compensating for the fact that in those stages, the person who's controlling Kirby is going to be distracted all the time and is not going to be able to attack the enemies himself, because he's going to try to keep you alive. You know, he's going to try to keep those lines and, you know.
Yeah. That sounds very appealing. I'm glad you're putting up this spirited defense, because it actually makes the game a lot more appealing to me.
It feels like the helper character needs more agency of their own, though. It needs to be more than essentially Kirby's fucking stand. I mean,
No, but I mean, it's more like playing regular Kirby. Like, I don't know how else to put it. But at the same time, you're not going to be able to go everywhere to do everything on your own because you're not going to have the jumping power to get up to where you need to be, right? Like, you need to rely on Kirby. And meanwhile, the person controlling Kirby has to rely on you because you're just so much better at dispatching the enemies. And,
But they don't really have to rely on you, though, because the game can be beaten without
support. I guess so, but I'm not sure if I would enjoy
but
that
But if the
experience.
Argument is that playing by yourself, you don't have to worry about this other character, you don't have to babysit this other character who doesn't have very much mobility, then maybe it balances out.
Yeah, but it's not an issue of it does it balance out, it's an issue of is that, you know, a fun experience for both players.
Well, just play it by yourself then. I don't know. Like, right now, the experience is pretty good, although Karen finds the game frustrating. Like, she doesn't really have the hang of the controls yet. And I find the game frustrating too sometimes because the game is not on the, you know, easy baby side, James. It's really like there's a lot of levels where it's auto-scrolling and you're already, like, I've had underwater stages where you're, you know, caught in a stream and you're going incredibly fast, you know, sonic fast, and you're trying to collect these things on the way and avoid spikes, and it's really hard. So
yeah. My issue, and maybe, I mean, it extends beyond this game, and it's sort of this rolling problem I have with asynchronous gameplay as Nintendo has manifested it, is that it always sort of feels like the secondary player is a secondary player. And that often means the idea is like, oh, well, don't worry. It's for like when you're playing with little kids. Mm. But to me, that just doesn't feel right. Like, make the two experiences should be equally interesting. There needs to be an opportunity for the second player to have a unique but as interesting and as involved experience as the player with the gamepad. Otherwise, that person is effectively just you know, an accessory.
Well, I completely agree, but Guillaume is basically saying that that's what they've accomplished here, right?
Yeah, and I can say that sometimes I'm, you know, I want to be playing as the helper and Karen wants to be playing as the helper. Like, sometimes it's just, you know, it's...
Why?
Well,
what's the
it's
reason?
Less frustrating. It's more traditional, and I don't know. It's still fun.
James, I don't know if you remember Canvas Curse, but it's hard to make Kirby go where you want him to, which is the fun of it. But it's definitely frustrating.
I get that, but then my question is, we have this game that's not really. It's a Kirby game in name, but it's not really about being Kirby. I mean, they took away like things like powers, which granted is not in the first Kirby game, but it's in subsequent games. But what, you know, if you're the helper, then you're not really playing, you're not really getting to experience this new kind of gameplay. You're really just doing what we did in New Super Mario Bros. U, which is the person with the gamepad creates.
If only there was a way to swap back and forth roles. Like, I don't know. How could possibly do that? I don't know.
My point is that if they're going to create a unique kind of experience for one player, maybe they should invest the effort to give both people, you know, something new to try. It always feels like, okay, we can tack on a secondary player here. They can just do whatever.
This is more than just pointing a cursor at a bunch of star bits. Like, you're playing platformer.
That was always kind of like, well, you can do this if you want. I mean, I never really thought that was like a key mode, but fine. Mm. It just seems like the helper is really just there. The getting them to the end of the level is your tax, so you can have something hammer the crap out of the boss for you.
There's a little bit of that.
Seem to be a trade-off involved there, yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on, because, Guy, I know you haven't finished the game. I'd love to hear a follow-up next week. Sure. Maybe, you know, your thoughts might evolve a little bit towards the end, but we have a lot more stuff to talk about. And most pressingly, Mr. Lindemann, I need to hear about your hunting exploits.
All right. Man, that Kirby stuff just escalated quickly.
Yeah.
you just wait.
I was just grabbing popcorn.
I've been sharpening daggers for this, John.
All right. Well, let's talk about Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate for 3DS.
Yeah, and a game that I may or may not have in my new 3DS right now.
That's good to hear. So... I consider myself a savvy veteran of the series, I would say. But I'm also kind of a harsh critic of it too, right? Because pretty much when I deal with a Monster Hunter game, I kind of expect bullshit, and I'm fine with it because I know what to
with.
I know what to do, right? But, you know, so I kind of went into this. So when you boot up the game, it pretty much asks you right off the bat, do you want tutorials or not? And so I wanted to see, you know, what they actually did, because I wasn't really expecting much. Yeah. You know, they say, you know, hey, you know, there's tutorials. Yeah, but most of the time in previous games, they've been buried in a sub-menu, you know, and you have to scroll through, you know, 8 pages of text to actually get to the information that you want to get to. And, you know, it's – and also, you know, you're never really – when stuff happens, you're just – like, you're just thrown typically in past games. You've been just thrown into, you know, the world to hunt a monster, and you're really not told what to do at all. So I turn on the tutorials right off the bat, and they're actually really, really good. So up to this point, I've been waiting for the game to let me down, and that hasn't really happened. I've actually been really impressed. The tutorial stuff is...
It's a Capcom seal of quality.
Well, you know, it's amazing because they've... what
I've been waiting for it to let me down.
I mean, everything that they've done, I have yet to see something that doesn't really make any sense to me, or something that has been... something that has been left out. The way they tackle it, you know, one of the first things, one of the problems with past games has been, well, you know, like, you know, they have all kinds, you know, you can use swords, you can use guns, you can use, in this one, you can use the insect glaive, which is something totally new. And you've never really been shown how to actually use them in past games. You've just kind of had to figure it out on your own. And there's been some token attempts here and there, but there's never been anything really structured to actually take you through and show you how to use these things. So what they do in this one, which is very smart, is the first tier of quests. I think there's about 10 quests in there. Only 2 of them are mandatory, and they're just, you know, go out and, you know.
And fetch some meat and
fetch some meat, cook some meat, or like, you know, get some berries or whatever, just kind of BS quests. And then the rest of them, the other ones, they are all training quests for the insect glaive and all that kind of stuff. So, and they're completely optional. So, you know, I'm a great sword guy just because that's the only one that I ever bothered like learning how to use, just because it was such a pain in the ass to use everything else, and figure it out. Because, I mean, it's not just, you know, like something with like the gun lance, I think it is. I mean, there's more to it. I mean, with some of these things, I mean, you have to, like with the guns, you have to carry ammo with you. You have to like learn how to make the ammo. You know, you can run out of ammo, and like, there's just a whole bunch of stuff. It's not just like, oh, it's a different type of sword or something like that. There's always some kind of a hook to everything. So it's never simple. So it's really good. I haven't actually gone through any of the tutorial quests, but I think I will eventually for the insect glaive once I kind of get a little bit more advanced, because I'm curious about that. I've tried everything else in past games.
Yeah, actually, that's the last thing that I did earlier today. I learned how to use the charge blade, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember, like in Monster Hunter Tri, there was that quest where you go get some meat and cook it and then make a potion. But I don't think they had this, weapons training thing where they just drop you basically inside a, Colosseum basically teach you, okay, these are the controls, and they kind of explain to you, okay, well, like with a charge blade, you swing around with a sword and it charges it up, like you get vials of some stuff or other, and then you can transform it into an axe, and that's super powerful, and then you press this button to discharge it, and then you get back to the sword. And anyway, so they explain everything, and then they let you wail on a great jaggy, I think, like right there and then, you know, so you don't have to hunt it down. You don't have to do any of the monster hunt, like the preparations kind of stuff. It's just, here's how you use this weapon, and now you get to use it, which is...
And it makes sense, right?
It does.
Yeah. That's what I find myself saying over and over again, is that, yeah, that makes sense.
Right. So, I think it's helpful because I never got past the tutorial on Monster Hunter Tri. Like, I just moved on to something else, and I don't think I ever hunted any non-herbivore creatures, you know? So, I'm looking forward to doing that now. The thing is, though, the tutorials might not be, like, super, you know, up to par because, I still don't really know how to use the charge blade. I get a feeling I'm going to have to get through this tutorial once more, because there's some stuff, some technical stuff about the vials or whatever that I'm not sure I understood. But I'm definitely glad that this training is in there.
Yeah, it's
John, does it,
go ahead, James.
Does it teach you about other stuff like farming and all the other weird shit this game has in it?
I haven't gotten there yet. I haven't actually found any of the farming stuff yet. I'm not even HR2 yet. I haven't had a lot of time to play through the solo stuff.
You're not even what?
At Hunter Rank 2. Well, let me explain. Okay. I mean, the first, you get through the first tier of quests. Actually, I believe for the first Hunter Rank, I think there's three tiers of quests. And I'm right at the very end where I go up to Hunter Rank 2. I think I have to do like one more quest that is, I think it's actually just a gathering quest or something, but, So the tutorial stuff is really, really good. But more importantly, what I really wanted to see, so that's cool. You know, they have tutorial quests for all that kind of stuff. But what happens when you're actually, because the problem I always had with Monster Hunter up to this point was they throw you in against monsters and they really don't, there's even stuff in the environment that you're like, okay, what the hell do I do with this stuff? What, like, okay, I can pick it up, but what the hell am I doing? Why do I need it? And they actually introduce that to you in a very smart way. When you encounter a bug that you can collect with a bug net, you know, as soon as you walk over to it, the game pauses and it says, hey, you found a bug. You capture it with a bug net, and then you take it back and you do this with it. And you're like, wow, okay, that actually makes sense. And it's like that with everything.
Like before, you would have had to look up an FAQ or something.
You wouldn't even have known what you need to capture the bug. In fact, actually, back in Monster Hunter Freedom Unite, they didn't even, like, they, you know, you have, like, the nodes out in each of these areas, you know, where you can, like, get bugs or, you know, gather herbs or whatever. They didn't even have an icon to tell you when you were standing over a node. So you literally had to know it by sight. That's how ridiculous it was. So I think in Monster Hunter 3, they actually added the little icon, to tell you that, hey, you're over a node.
And press A.
Yep. And now they actually go as far as to say when you walk over to a node the first time, they say, hey, this is a blah, blah, blah. This is what you have to do to gather it. And this is what you can use it for. So it shows you. And it's also the same thing when you're fighting a monster, like with the Great Sword. Eventually, if you hit a monster enough, the Great Sword will get dull. And then you have to pull out a whetstone and sharpen it again. Well, when your sword gets dull for the first time, it says, hey, your sword is dull. Pull out a whetstone and sharpen it. You know, take a break from the action, step away and sharpen your sword, because if it gets dull, you know, you can't hit as hard, and some monsters you won't be able to hit at all, and your sword will bounce off of them. So it does everything in a very smart manner. Really introduces you to everything as it happens, which is the best way to do it, because a lot of the stuff you kind of, unless you see it happening in context, and like in the context of fighting a monster, you're not really going to understand how it all kind of fits. So.
Right. So it goes back to the demo we were talking about, where it's like, hey, here's the insect life. Here's 40 pages of text about the insect life. Have fun.
Yeah. And I mean, James can tell you, if you don't have something that actually steps you through how to use the insect life, you're going to be like, what the hell is going on? I don't even know what this thing does. How do I hit stuff? And it's the same thing with the guns.
Or as it was, John, I'm red now. What does that mean?
I don't know. You know, and so the fact that it kind of handholds you through that stuff is really good, and it's really impressive. And the only thing I've found so far that hasn't really been explained very well is jumping on monsters, which is one of the new things they added. So now in Monster Hunter 4, you can now jump onto a monster and you stab them on the back and you hurt them while you're doing that. And then they try to – it's kind of a game where they can like try to shake you off, and you have to hold down, I think, the R trigger or whatever, or the – to, you know, try to hold on while you stab them. And then I think if you successfully complete the kind of the game, it's, you know, the monster, I think, gets stunned, and then you can hop down and hit the monster while it's on the ground. So, and at first, I mean, they just tell you, okay, well, you know, you use A to climb up, a cliff, because that's the other thing that they've added to all of the environments. You know, they all have cliffs, and they're very vertical now. Whereas before, you really just had, you know, inclines and declines, some cliffs, but usually only, you know, at the start where you would be jumping down into the environment. But now it's actually like in an area. I mean, areas are still closed off, but in an area, you will have a cliff and you have to go down the cliff and go down another one down to the bottom. So things are very, you're climbing a lot more. And at first I wasn't really very impressed by this, but once I got the hang of actually being able to jump onto monsters, what's cool about it, because at first I was like, who cares? I mean, you know, so what? You can jump on monsters, but what's really cool about it is that you can actually change the way you fight. And what I've started doing is I've started to purposely lure monsters, you know, when I'm in an area with, you know, cliff faces and, you know, kind of, you know, stuff that I can jump off of. You can actually lure monsters and set them up so that you can purposely, like, so you can lure them down below, climb up the cliff face and have them come up to you and then jump onto their back. So it kind of gives you a new way to attack them instead of just, you know, the old usual, you know, kind of, you know, dodge and then run up behind them and hack them. It just kind of adds a whole new, you know, way to, yeah, like just a whole new way to attack them. So it's really interesting. At first I wasn't too impressed by it, but once you actually start, where it really comes into play is with the flying monsters, because they'll, you know, they sort of set themselves up for it sometimes. And once I started doing that, I was like, okay, this is actually really cool. So that's really good. Let's see. What else? I haven't tried any online play yet. I know that we had issues with it when James and I played, but I'm expecting it to be better in the retail version.
Yeah, I mean, it was mostly just it wasn't once we were in the game. That was generally okay.
Yeah.
It was the establishing a game and actually trying to play something.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of all the online stuff, they've added there's a lot of stuff that they've added. Like, it is considerably better than Monster Hunter 3 in many ways, not just in the gameplay, but I mean, they have just a lot of it feels streamlined. I know that like the area where I'm at right now, I'm just about ready to move to a new town, but also in the first town that you're in, you can also, they used to just have kind of a free hunting mode, but now they kind of have this other mode where you can, they kind of send you out on quests. There's still free hunting quests, but you can go out and you can hunt all kinds of monsters. And as you kill monsters, those monsters can show up. So it's cool. And there's other kind of different things they've done with vendors as well, where, they have a vendor called the Wycoon, who you can give him, items, which, and this comes into play. It's one of those things that I like, because one of the things that kind of wasted the player's time in other games is like, oh, you ran out of herbs. Well, the only way that you can go and get herbs is by taking one of these free hunt quests and just going around gathering herbs. It's really a pain in the ass, right? It takes a lot of time. And it's not fun. Like, it's just grindy, busy work just to,
Just go out there, grab herbs, like press A a bunch of times, watch the animation, and it's boring.
Yeah. And so this, you can't do this for all the items. It's mainly stuff like herbs and mushrooms, but those are the kind of, very basic items that you use to combine to actually make better items, like better potions and stuff like that. So what you can do is this mode where you can give him items, and then over time you can kind of get them back from him, and he'll create more of them for you. So you can sort of, you can increase your stock of items by giving them to this guy, and he holds them for a while. And I think you pay him. There's kind of some sort of currency. It's like these a certain type of seeds or something like that. So, and the more you give him, the more he gives you back. You know, the more you pay him effectively, the more he gives you back of whatever you give him. Stuff like that. But it's an alternate way to not have to go out into the environment. And
so
just
they didn't have things. They didn't have things like this in old Monster Hunter games.
No.
Because that's kind of a trademark of the crafting, collecting Japanese game, where there's always this person who you give one random doodad and they give you copies of it for a price.
No, you could – I think I suspect that this probably replaces farming, because they did have this. They did have this sort of – I mean, you could farm items, right? So you could
right.
It was very, very similar. Like, you could plant something, and then you would get back a certain type of berry or a certain type of herb or something like that. But it was kind of convoluted. It wasn't – it just, as a mode, it was something that was just kind of a pain in the ass. And it kind of went down the whole avenue of, you have to pull out an FAQ file, because if you want this, you have to find these two ingredients. And if you don't have those two ingredients, you have to go out into the environment and find out where they are, because they're only in this one certain place. And then you have to go and press A a bunch of times.
That's not how farming works. You don't
know.
Combine two. Well, I mean, unless you're making hybrids.
Yeah, I mean.
So that's all better now.
You're not making honey crisp apples over there.
Yeah, man, as far as I can tell, it's
John,
a lot better.
It's painful to hear you praise this game so much.
Yeah,
because you're really making me think about buying it, and I don't know if I can handle that.
I mean, it's
John talks a mess.
I don't know, man. I don't.
Do you think
have
this is the
lot.
One to finally get into?
I think if you're thinking of trying it, this is definitely the one because they actually tell you in a sensible manner how to play the game.
Yeah.
Which has never, yeah. I've never seen it in a Monster Hunter title.
And I just find the beginning of the game more engaging. Right now, like I'm just wondering why hasn't anyone told me that Monster Hunter was this funny? You know,
I remember
try just being kind of drab. Like I did not enjoy the world. I did not enjoy the beginning, the first town.
I mean, they're Capcom games. That's what you just keep in mind. They're Capcom games. So the humor is going to be cheesy, and most of the time you're going to go, God, that's terrible. What are you doing?
Rumor has it this was actually 8-4 Play were the guys that did the
translation. Yeah, this was 8-4. But they did try as well. Or at least they did 3 Ultimate for sure. I think they did try.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the humor, though, is in the original Japanese, too.
But honestly, John, I mean, you saying that the beginning part of the game is better, that's a huge deal because the thing about Monster Hunter that everybody always said is once you get through the first 10 or 15 hours, it becomes incredibly addictive and fun. And it's like, I played five hours of Try, and I didn't enjoy any of it.
Yeah.
So if they've focused on the first 10 hours, it sounds like that's the part of the game that really needed the attention.
I mean, the reason why it took you 10 hours to get into it was because it took you 10 hours to figure out what you were doing.
Yeah.
Because nobody told you anything about it. Like, it's just like,
and
okay,
there's
going to
be a learning phase, but you have to make that stuff enjoyable to some extent.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they finally did. So
yeah,
I will probably end up buying this, and I'm really afraid for myself.
But I've been interested
in the series for so long. And I mean, I gave it the old college try a couple times.
Yeah.
And just not happening. But maybe.
Yeah.
So, John, one other question for you before we move on to something else, because you're going to be playing this for a long time, I'm sure, and we'll have other chances to talk about it. Do you get the sense so far that you wish you could play this on a console? Because this, I mean, Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate is only on 3DS.
Mm-hmm.
I
would welcome it. I don't think on 3DS you're necessarily missing a whole lot. I mean, because I'm playing it on the old 3DS with Circle Pad Pro, which I think is, you could argue that's probably the best way to play it. But I mean, just because I really like having the dual joysticks. On a console, I mean, it'd be good, but I mean, I didn't really play Monster Hunter, Monster Hunter Tri. I didn't really play that much on Wii either. It's just like, for me, the environments look a bit better, but the gameplay is still the same. So,
well, you had both versions for 3 Ultimate. You had both the 3DS version and the Wii U version. Which one did you end up playing the most?
The 3DS version by far, because I can take it with me.
Okay.
You know, because
you do feel that it is a good portable game.
Well, yeah, it's a good portable game.
I mean, that's what they're built as originally, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good portable game because all of the gameplay is time boxed. So you have to get all your quests done in 50 minutes or your time runs out.
Or your pizza's free.
Yeah, but James, you're a little bit wrong on your history there, because the series did start out as PS2. And although it didn't become super popular in Japan until the PSP versions came out.
The version that we're playing now morphed once it made that jump to PSP to become more and more mobile. I mean, what you're playing now is effectively the evolution of that first PSP game.
Understood. But Monster Hunter does have its roots in console gaming. And up till now, there have been console versions of virtually every game. I mean, they even went back and made consoleized versions of the portable games because they were so popular in Japan. And I suspect down the road at some point, may not be on Wii U, maybe it'll be PS4, who knows. But at some point, I feel like there probably will be a console version of this, but maybe there's no reason to wait. You know, maybe 3DS is, especially with the new 3DS, that kind of tips the scales for me also. Would be really good to play on my new system.
Yeah, it would be good on the new 3DS.
I wouldn't be particularly surprised if they didn't, because...
yep.
I mean, what's the market incentive for them? It's got to sell more than enough in Japan to make it worth the cost of production. But with the 3DS being the market leader in Japan by some absurdist number.
Yeah.
There's really no financial incentive for Capcom to make another SKU of this game.
Yeah. You might be right. Maybe it would take a console resurgence in Japan that may never happen.
Yep.
Maybe so.
Nintendo needs to fork out the dough.
Maybe after Dragon Quest XI comes out, it'll be, if that ends up being a console game, then maybe that will spike sales. I suspect that 11 will be a 3DS game, but so far, Square Enix has maintained that it will be a console game.
Square Enix
game,
is still chuckling around with Dragon Quest X SKUs right now, so I mean, whatever.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway.
Now, the one thing I will add is a nice little touch that they add is you have your little feline character that runs around with you and sort of can sometimes tank monsters away from you and kind of save your butt every once in a while, but also just runs around and acts kind of annoying. But one of the things that they did
like
is
true Capcom character.
You can go online and download kind of a little starter pack that gives you some items that lets you buy outfits for your feline. And
not real money, right?
No.
Okay.
No, they're actually items.
Because they would do that.
I wouldn't put it past them, but they're items I think that you can find in game. They're rare items, but anyways, so you can change outfits, and so of course the first outfits that they allow you to get are a Mario and a Luigi outfit and the super hammer. So of course my feline, the first thing I did was I grabbed the hammer and grabbed the Mario outfit. So I now have my feline running around with the massive hammer. And a Mario outfit, so it's pretty ridiculous.
So Capcom basically looked at Super Mario 3D World and said, "We will not be upstaged by Mario in a cat suit."
Mm-hmm. Yep. Tit for tat.
Yep.
Just gonna put a cat in a Mario suit.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, remember, this is the complete same opposite game that sent out the Mega Man is Back press release, and it was fucking cat armor.
That's good
fuck
stuff.
You, Capcom. I don't need this.
Yeah,
I would rather
have
Mega Man cat armor than Mario or Luigi cat armor.
I would rather have Mega Man, period, than Mega Man cat armor.
I mean, I can honestly say though, if they did do something like, hey, you can buy some stupid character as a feline,
Frank West, I would probably
put some money down on that. I'm not ashamed to say that.
I think you're going to get your wish, John, because I think there is DLC coming for this game.
It's been free up to this point. They've had DLC for the other games too, and it's been free. But
yeah, but I think there is some paid DLC announced. I don't know the details of it.
The paid DLC barrier is down on 3DS at this point, so I would not be surprised at all.
Bring it. Yeah.
Well, James, why don't you tell us about your new business in this giant size segment? It's what it's looking like.
We're at 48 right now, so we'll figure it out. So I had the week off, and normally when I take the week off, I procure an RPG to play. This time around, my JRPG got stuck in the mail, so we didn't get to play that. So I went to this stack of PS3 games. It's about 4 or 5 deep. The one that I grabbed was actually the Eco Shadow of the Colossus HD dual disc or dual pack game. So I never played either of these games on the PS2 because this is Pokemon on the show. I didn't have access, full-time access to a PS2 at all, essentially. So I've been playing catch-up on the PS3 a lot, and besides playing a bunch of Ace Combat games and some weird JRPGs that people don't really talk about, not as opposed to JRPGs people actually do talk about, like Final Fantasy and stuff, I've been kind of, using my PS3 more as a PS2 system, but it was nice to be able to get the HD remix. So I was told that I needed to play Eco first. Just do that one first. It's the one I wasn't really interested in. I always wanted to play Shadow of the Colossus. Eco never really interested me. I'm glad I played it because I've spent some time thinking about how I want to talk about it on the show. And there's not much to say because I'm sure most people listening are at least aware of what this game is. But essentially, you are a boy with horns who is trapped in a castle and is leading this girl trying to escape. I mean, that's essentially the whole thing. And there's a bunch of puzzles to open doors or get over walls, get through holes, etc., 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 to essentially progress through the castle. Each room is sort of its own puzzle, and you have to figure out how to get into the next room. It's about five...
The game is basically one long escort mission, and that's exactly as fun as it sounds.
I don't quite agree with that, but I think Eco is a good game that plays terribly.
Yes, that is. Yeah. That's that. I mean, that's kind
of... It's a good game. It's actually worth playing through. I mean, it's very charming, and you'll probably have warm, fuzzy memories of it afterwards, but it's not that much fun in the moment. Like, the things that your character can do don't really feel good, and it's kind of glitchy, and
yeah,
there's a lot of weird animation, like edging to the edges of platforms, and jumping is bad. And
the jumping is...
It's a mess.
So when I play the game, though, I was having lots of weird thoughts, like, oh... I can see it, there is a certain degree of obviously Zelda dungeon inspiration going on here. Because it's essentially you go into a room, there's a puzzle to make the door open to go to the next room, figure out how to solve this puzzle. But it's super pulled back. Both literally, the camera's usually stuck up in a corner somewhere, although you can kind of manipulate it. And from a more figurative sense, where you go into a room and there's not usually the standard Zelda visual cues of, hey, there's this thing over here. It's the only thing in the room that's got light on it. You should probably do something. Yeah. Instead, you kind of have to gaze around the room for a little bit and kind of look for stuff that isn't, you know, just uniform gray bricks. And odds are that's probably where you need to go. And then you have to sort of figure out, what's the game trying to get me to do? Can I bring Yorda, which is the girl you're escorting around, can I bring her with me, or do I have to find someplace safe to stash her while I go do something so I can go get her later? The puzzles themselves I actually really like in general.
Yeah, me too. I think they're the strong suit.
I think a lot of, to me, when I play this game, like, this is the kind of exploration game that I enjoy, because it's not linear. I mean, there's opportunities to go different directions, but you are sort of led along, you know, you go to the next area. It may be a big open area. You have to spend some time exploring that small slice of the world. But ultimately, something will eventually catch your eye, and you have to go dig around and figure out how to get through it. And to me, I really enjoyed that element. It's sort of, and what I was thinking about, this is sort of like the alternate, extreme alternate path a 3D conversion of Zelda could have taken. And I see, like, I understand why they auto jump in Ocarina of Time, because jumping in this game, is fucking miserable.
Yeah, you know, Eco started as a PS1 game, and then it was, like, very late in development, converted into a PS2 game, and then was eventually remastered as a PS3 game, and now you can also play it on PS4, I think.
So,
I think.
Maybe. The thing that actually, on that story, to finish it off, originally, your character didn't have horns. It wasn't this big. I mean, this castle is huge. It is enormous. There are hundreds of rooms in it. And originally, it wasn't just this abandoned ruin. It was a castle, and you were like a castle servant escorting a princess out because she had been imprisoned for some reason. And the reason they put horns on the character was because they felt that playtesters, so it had gotten this far, playtesters couldn't tell what character you were controlling with the way zoomed out camera. So they put on horns to give it visual distinctness. And then they completely re-engineered the game to change the story around the fact that you now have horns. Like, this game is the product of an auteur. I mean, just 100%. Because he joins Sony.
And a very torturous development process. But the reason I introduced the history lesson is just to point out, this game probably was a direct follow-up from Ocarina of Time.
Probably, yeah.
Probably inspired by Ocarina of Time, and Ueda said, hey, I could do something like that, but a little different. And he went off, and he just started making it, and it turned out to be Eco. So I think all the comparisons to Zelda are completely valid, and so in some ways it compares very poorly to Zelda, but I think if you love Zelda, especially if you love 3D Zelda, Eco is like you said, it's like this weird parallel world version of what might have happened, and it's fascinating.
And for that extent, for the puzzle solving, for the exploration, I fucking love this game. It's things like the jumping or having to get right on the edge so you can hit the button to reach down and help Yorda up, but instead you just fall off the edge.
Yeah, the mechanics are, like, the combat is terrible.
Oh, the combat's so bad!
But the game, it plays really poorly, but it's so beautiful, and it's so imaginative, and it's so evocative. I mean, the feel, the mood of this game is you're wandering this lonely, desolate castle, and you're leading this poor, helpless, miserable girl around with you it leaves a really emotional impression on you.
The one thing that I looked up how to do in this game, and I beat it in about between 5 and 6 hours, so it's a pretty short game.
Did you get stuck on the windmill?
No.
The water wheel?
Nope, cruised right through it.
That gave me a hell of a time.
Cruised right through this game. The only thing I looked up was, why is the combat so bad? And then there's a secret weapon that you can get. I would have not found it if I hadn't looked up. It had somebody hadn't posted. Just get the spike ball. And I'm like, well, it's a spike ball. I went and searched it. I found the door, the secret door, but I wouldn't have figured out how to do all the rest of the puzzle to get it. So once you get that, basically it's like one or two hits and everything goes down and the combat just doesn't matter anymore. But like, that's so late in the game. That's like hour three. It's just going from place to place in this game, solving the puzzles. You know, you start to pick up on the goofy control and stuff, and you kind of start to work around it. Like the jumps when there's like a chain dangling from the ceiling and you're at some three quarters angle, so you can't really tell if you're standing under it. There's usually like a rust spot on the ground right under the chain where water's been dripping off. So you go, okay, I'm standing on the rust spot. I'm okay. I can jump now. Or when you're jumping, when the camera has gone perpendicular to you and you're jumping across a gap, which is exactly the right angle you should be at when you're trying to gauge distance. Usually there's like a little brown, like, trail of dirt on the side you're running from to tell you the path you should take to do a running jump, but it takes so long to learn this shit and you die so many unnecessary times. Yeah. Like, one of the trophies for this game is clear the game in under 2 hours. I'm like, no. The other one is don't die ever. And I'm like, how on earth? Like, yeah. It seems impossible. But, I mean, when I play this game, it seems like an extreme distillation of one element of the 3D Zelda space. And my issue I had with Link Between Worlds, you know, that the puzzles are super obvious, that they're just the same kind of puzzles over and over again, that the one thing you need to interact with is super highlighted in the room, or it's just a button under a pot. Like, this is the exact opposite of it. And I think that's why I really enjoyed it. Some of the most interesting kind of puzzle solving that I've seen in this kind of game, possibly ever. And I just really got into that. I mean, like I said, I played the first, I played about 4 hours of this straight. And then went and got dinner and then pretty much finished the game.
Wow.
So in a day. I mean, I cleared this game in a day. And it's,
I'm a little surprised that you liked it that much, but it makes sense now that you've explained it in that way.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot of this game where I'm just like, God damn it, Eco! Just do what I tell you! But
have we all four played through Eco now?
I never finished it. Like, okay. I hated the act of playing. There is a lot to like about it. I did love the environments and I did like the puzzles, but the combat and the controls, I just couldn't get over them. And I realized eventually every time that I would get to a save point, I would save and stop playing because it was a relief. And they're not that far apart, you know?
It's so a stressful game.
Yeah, so I just stopped. Reasons. Like, I was like, okay, obviously I'm not enjoying this, and I stopped playing.
I would always do this. Well, I'll stop at the next save point, and then because they're so close together, I'm like, well, I can do one more, and that just stretched out for the whole afternoon. And of course, I mean, I was off all week. You know, I'm not doing anything, so that was like, okay, I started at like 11, and at like 3, I was like, all right, I got to put this down for a little while, and then I came back later in the evening and just sort of finished the game off, and then I rolled immediately into Shadow of the Colossus.
Well, hold on. We didn't hear from John.
Well, John's cat was barfing.
Yeah, sorry. I'm trying to think if I've played Eco. I definitely have it somewhere. I don't think I've played it.
Oh, okay.
It's like Shadow of the Colossus version, but not Eco.
I would, if you have, on PS2, it's pretty hard to go back to. On PS3, that's definitely the way to go.
Yeah.
If not, You can play these on like PS Now if you want to do a free trial or something, or you can usually pick them up on a PSN sale for like super cheap.
Well, so I mean, honestly, if you're going to sit down and just play it, I beat it in about five to six hours. It's not very long.
So it's perfect for PS Now.
You can just get like the 10-hour, like $2 PS Now version of it and just right. Just like say, I've blocked off this afternoon, I'm going to beat this game, and then just be like, later, Eco.
Yeah, I find it hard to sit down for 5 hours to play a game, though. I don't know.
I spent a week playing through Eco, and I was.
That's the thing. I'm pretty sure at some point this has been on PS Plus, and I probably downloaded it.
I just enjoyed Shadow of the Colossus so much more.
Well, so actually,
it's a better game.
Well,
it is.
There's one more thing I want to talk about with Eco first, and that is just this, the idea of just setting a scene in that game is so, it's so core to what that game is and why that game is enduring. Because the guy who made this game had no experience making video games. It's a partnership between him and the guy who made Ape Escape. Which you see that sometimes when you're playing the game. You're like, oh yeah, the guy who made Ape Escape made this. Yeah, I can tell. But he just came in with this idea. I mean, his interview with Sony when he was asked why he wanted to join, I want to make a game called Eco. And that was his answer to why do you want to join Sony? And like, he made a video, like in a 3D modeler, like showing off some stuff, and Shuhei Yoshida was so impressed, he threw the guy with Apescape on. Okay, go make a game. That's how that game happened.
The PS3 version of this comes with a video interview with Ueda that is highly worth watching.
Yeah,
he is quite a character.
Yep.
Really interesting person to listen to.
I played Shadow of the Colossus right afterwards. You know, I started it and then just gunned for like 2 hours. And in those 2 hours, I killed about 6 of the Colossi.
Oh, jeez. You're blazing through it.
I assume they get longer after this. Or do they all just kind of take the same amount of time? Because, I mean, they're going down.
Some of the battles do get pretty protracted.
The third one I spent about 30 minutes on. But 4, 5, and 6 were done in 10 minutes after I got back to the temple from the previous. I mean, they're just going down.
Yeah.
I actually don't enjoy this game as much as I enjoyed Eco. And it's just because the climbing is so goddamn terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to kind of find out where you can kind of latch on to something.
It's just like, he'll get stuck in this, he'll get like stuck on the armpit of a Colossus and go into this dumb animation loop where he keeps getting bounced because he's only got 6 frames of animation on this one particular move and there's never a situation for him to take a step up. Like, he's not being jostled, it's just the animation keeps looping there, and he can't finish the animation because the Colossus' arm is in the way.
Yeah, it's janky.
Yeah, but like...
I mean, both of the games are just straight up janky.
But like, I really enjoyed the battle with the third one, which is this giant... I mean, they're all big, but this one's giant, has this long sword. And just getting to the top of it is a chore. Like, it takes forever to get up there, because it's so long. But then the next one, immediately, isn't that long. It's just very fast. It's like a horse. And you just have to trick it. You just have to make it like hide in a hole and then come out the other side and just come up its tail. And then I just hammered on it. And I didn't get jostled at all. I just kept hitting it until it died.
Have you done the flying one yet?
I did the flying one and the one after it.
The flying one is one of the most incredible experiences of any video game I've ever played.
There's this, I mean, essentially the flying one is you go on this relatively long hike compared to the previous ones that far to get to it. And then you come across this lake that you didn't see before. Like, it was hidden behind a mountain, and then you went around this mountain trail and came around, and there's just this lake there. And the Colossus is way off in the distance on a perch. It looks like a bird.
Mm-hmm.
And you piss it off with an arrow. And then you have to jump and catch it as it flies past you. And then you're just constantly trying to figure out your orientation relative to the ground and see if, is it safe for me to let go and recharge my grip and try to move to go to where I need to hit it? And I mean, for me, that I didn't get knocked off at any point during that one, but there was a moment where he had turned completely perpendicular to the ground and I had lost my grip and fell from one wing all the way down his body and grabbed the edge of his other wing. And like, that was the most intense moment I think I've had in a video game in a long time.
Yeah.
Like, I just go, grab, fuck! And then like I'm hanging literally at the very edge of him. And then I have to climb all the way back up his wings across his body to the other wing. It was really, really intense.
That's when that game, Shadow of the Colossus, that's when it's at its best. I mean, it's just like ass-clenching moments. Like, oh my god, am I going to lose all, you know, everything? And by the way, I think there's another flying one later that's
probably
even more amazing.
There was a moment in that fight where he was turned the opposite way perpendicular. And I thought, okay, I did this once. I need to get to the other wing. I can try to let go and see if I can catch myself on the other wing as opposed to trying to walk down there. And I did it, and I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever done. And it worked, and I felt like the biggest badass ever. But like, to me, the one thing about this game that's weird, it's a distillation of a very specific gameplay. It is the boss fight. I mean,
yeah, and there's almost nothing else in the game.
It's just you riding to the boss fight, and then
you can do a little bit of world exploration, and there, you know, you can find like extra save points, and I think you can find a couple things that increase your health meter.
Mm.
It's all very organic and sort of non-guided, you know, and there's just not really anything else to interact with in the world. That if the world had a little more natural wildlife and maybe some smaller monsters that you could just sort of kill for sport or something, I think that the game would kind of hold, you know, it would feel more immersive, I think, to its benefit. But yeah, it does feel like it's a world constructed to contain these monsters, and it exists for no other reason.
It's
too bad because it's so beautiful. I mean, you want to explore it, but then you start doing it, and you find there's not really anything here, you know?
Yep. Yeah, totally. I mean, I almost thought the idea was that this was just an abandoned ground, that nothing should be here except these colossi, and occasionally a bird you see.
There is some of that going on, definitely.
It's those two games are weird, like extremely distilled components of gameplay that I don't like. That's the kind of thing now you'd see as like an indie game, but there's no way an indie game would have the budget to do this. It's so insane these games exist. I mean,
that's why I really want The Last Guardian to actually come out, and I think it will eventually. I hope, but
I mean, he's left Sony, which complicates matters.
I think his work on the game is basically done. I think they're in a very torturous conversion process to upgrade that to PS4 game. I think the game design is finished.
They let their trademark lapse to The Last Guardian.
They did.
I believe.
Yeah, that was a bureaucratic fuck up.
Not that it means anything, but.
Here's what I would love to see happen, and this is where heresy starts to kick in. I would like to see him just sit down with another company, Nintendo, and just say, here's some ideas I've got.
Yeah.
And then don't let him touch any gameplay decisions whatsoever.
I would love for him to just come work for Nintendo, because I think Nintendo will put the harness on him.
They won't put the Ape Escape dude on these games.
Yeah. No.
By the way, you may remember Ape Escape as being a good game, because that's because we were stupid. Go back and play that game. They're bad.
It was fun. It was silly, but fun.
They just play really poorly.
But yeah, I wonder, like, what aspect of Zelda is The Last Guardian going to, you know, become this bizarre treatise upon? Because I want to know what it is.
Concern is that they're going to try to do the whole thing end to end. They're not going to try to pick this one thing and just super distill it. And I think that's why these games work, because they're this incredibly focused experience where they've concentrated down something to just purely one element of the game
and done very thoughtfully.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not reductivist. It's like, here is my favorite part of Zelda. I'm going to make a game that's all about that, but I'm going to make that part of it really good.
You can't do an end-to-end version of this. You just can't do it. I mean, the amount of effort it would take. It goes back to when every time Square Enix talked about being asked to remake Final Fantasy VII, it's like, if you made Final Fantasy VII now on current gaming hardware, you'd bankrupt the company. It's too big. We can't do it. Like, if you tried to put that much thought into every element end-to-end of a Zelda game, you'd kill yourself. You just can't. It's just not something you could do. So, I want that game to be something hyper focused like these, but I'm not sure what's left besides just grunt work combat and then doing stupid side quests and villages. And these games are so focused on the fact that you and other person are the only person in it.
Well, you know, and I think that's the cause of some concern and mumblings right now among Nintendo fans with the new Zelda on Wii U is that, you know, Nintendo is almost exclusively focused on exploring this big world that they've created and being able to do it in a nonlinear way. And I think there's a lot of concern that, you know, Nintendo can't do that and also make great dungeons with amazing puzzles and also have an interesting story finally, or maybe continue to have an interesting story depending on your valuation of that. Nintendo has not done anything so far to, you know, assuage those concerns. I think they need to soon.
Yeah, because I need to see a good Zelda dungeon, because there was one and a half dungeons I liked in Skyward Sword. I mean, that's not a good number. That's a bad number. It was the one that I really liked is, of course, the part where you get that canyon where you mine the time travel stone, and you're constantly changing between everybody
that's
loves
really
it.
Cool.
That dungeon's amazing.
Very creative.
But every other dungeon in that game, I was like, eh. And then my thoughts on Link Between Worlds are pretty well established.
Yeah. I opened up a can there. All right. Well, let's move on. We'll find out enough about Zelda soon enough. If not before.
Maybe we will. I don't know.
Oh, it's good. Dude, that's why I'm going to E3 this year, because I'm going to play Zelda. It better be there. But anyway, my new business shouldn't take too long. It's a game that doesn't take too long, and that would be Star Fox 64 3D.
Nice.
That's a lot of numbers.
So you followed my advice, huh?
And what got, was your advice? Your,
to get with Club Nintendo coins this game.
Totally. Yeah, as soon as I found out this was one of the final Club Nintendo rewards, I said, oh, that's what I want to spend the bulk of my coins on, because it's a game I always kind of wanted, but, and I'm a huge fan of Star Fox 64. I mean, I've beaten this game. I got every medal on the hard version of every level in the game. I had everything on the N64. I just played the ever-loving shit out of it. And I still remember a lot of the little tricks and things like that. A lot of that stuff still holds up. But when this game came out on 3DS, I had just played it the year before on Virtual Console for Wii. Mm-hmm. And played, I mean, I think I got all the medals at least on the Wii version. So, I didn't necessarily need to play yet another version of Star Fox 64. I mean, it's a short game. There's not that much content in it, and it's content that I am extremely intimately familiar with. So I just didn't really feel like spending the $40 to go through it again. Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of weird stuff about it at the time. You know, you had these great developers at Q Games do a really, really nice conversion of it, but they add no content to the single player mode. There's no new levels or anything, which they seems like they could have easily done. I mean, it's not a big game in the first place. Seems right. like they could have added a couple extra levels just to give something fresh for the fans. And that would have swayed me. That would have easily pushed me over the line. And then they got rid of the original local multiplayer mode and made a new local multiplayer mode that didn't have any online functionality. And I just thought, that's ridiculous. I kind of like the original multiplayer because it was dumb and there wasn't anything like it on N64 at the time. But I don't think that mode holds up at all. I don't think it's actually fun to play nowadays. And I definitely don't want to do it with local only because then I'll never get to use it. So, at full price at $40, there's just no way I was going to buy this. And, I've come close a couple times when I saw it, you know, for like $15, $20. I've been very tempted. I thought, you know, I'd probably get $20 worth out of this thing, but I just never quite got pushed over the line. And then, yeah, for 700 coins on Club Nintendo, it's mine. And so I've played through the game a couple of times this week. Just to try a couple of different routes and to get a feel for what it looks like. And, you know, the 3D, you know, the other thing is, you know, I have the new 3DS now and I thought, well, maybe I can use the 3D with the gyro controls. Well, I can, and it holds the 3D pretty well. Problem is, I just don't like the gyro controls. That is not a way that I want to play this game ever. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't feel good. You can't really aim precisely, and it feels very disorienting to be, because, I mean, even if the 3D is stable, your mm-hmm. view of the screen is still changing as you tilt the screen all over the place. I mean, if you had a controller if the screen wasn't attached to the controls and you were moving the controller around, maybe that's okay. Yeah. And so maybe on the Wii U, it'll be all right because you're looking at the TV. The TV doesn't tilt when you tilt the controller. Maybe that's okay. But on the 3DS, I just don't think it feels good. I found it disorienting almost immediately and not accurate enough for the way I play this game. So.
Yeah, and also like the gyro controls worked well in something like the Ocarina of Time remake for aiming with the bow and arrow or stuff like that. But that's because usually you're planted on your feet, you know, you're not moving when you're aiming the mm-hmm. boomerang or whatever. And also the nothing snaps back to the center. Whereas in Star Fox, like your ship is always fighting against you, basically, like trying to be level.
Yeah,
so it just doesn't work stable. As well. Yeah.
It's not good. So gyro controls, I get the appeal. I understand why that Nintendo would think that that might be a fun way to play the game, but I don't think it's fun at all. So I turned that off almost immediately. But the 3D does look good. It's one of the better uses of 3D of any game, and it makes sense. I mean, it's a game where you play. You're looking into the perspective of the screen. You know, it's from behind the ship and you're moving at high speed and you're shooting into the background at enemies that are approaching you. I mean, it's just like Space Harrier. You know, you guys raved about that. You know, Star Fox is totally an evolution of Space Harrier, and it looks good in 3D for all the same reasons. So I've been very happy with the 3D effect. I think the graphical overhaul they did for this is great. I think it looks, other than the pop-up, there's some bad pop-up. I don't know if you noticed that, Guillaume, but
I've only played once through the game and only the hard difficulty, so I just okay. haven't well, seen on, everything.
On the Meteo stage, when you go through the asteroid field, the really humongous asteroids that pop up and they're like bowling balls, they knock into each other and you have to sometimes boost in between them or hit your brakes. Those things just pop up out of nowhere. Just like, oh, there it is. It's ridiculous. I don't even think it did that on 64. Not that I remember, but it's really jarring when you see it here. And then, what is it? Zonas, the big armada, battle stage right before Venom when you're on the hard track.
Right.
You know, there's these big, they look like big saucers with like spindles coming out, of either side of the plate. And they tilt towards you and start shooting at you when you get close to them. They're really big. They're hard to kill, but when you kill them, you get a lot of, bonus hits, you know, which helps you get a good score. Those things just like I found them extremely difficult to kill because they're only on the screen for like 3 seconds. It's like they're not there and then they appear out of nowhere and then they're shooting at you and then you're past them.
Okay. See, I'm not even familiar enough with the original game to have known that that was not supposed to happen.
No, it looks like they're decloaking. You know, they look like Klingon birds of prey. They're just like decloaking and then suddenly they're up in your face. You're like, oh God, it's not supposed to be that way. They're supposed to approach from, you know, far off.
It's supposed to be menacing. Like you're about to run down an armada.
You're supposed to see them coming and you're like, oh man, I don't know. Those things look really big. They're far off, but I think I'm going to have, you know, they're hard to take down. Yeah, it's bad. It's not good. So that's disappointing. But, overall, the textures and everything. Again, it's like Majora's Mask. It basically looks like a Dreamcast game now. I mean, it's a really slick looking upgrade of an N64 game.
Right. So, Johnny, can you tell me, like, what are the differences, when you can choose between two modes? There's the kind of the 3DS mode and the N64 mode. One is more faithful and the other one is supposed to be kind of remixed to take into account the fact that you're playing on a 3DS. They mentioned the gyro in the description, but they also say
tuned for gyro and the circle pad.
I see.
Which is weird because the circle pad is basically just the analog stick that you played with on N64. I mean, it's it's functionally the same.
So is it like the enemy placement? Does that change? Or
I honestly cannot tell any difference. I've played through the game once in each mode, and some of the stages I played in both. You know, like Corneria, you always play Corneria. It's the first stage before anything branches. So and there were a couple others that I played on both modes, and I honestly could not tell any difference. So whatever it is, it's subtle. Maybe it's difficulty, maybe it's number of enemies in certain scenes, but it's really pretty subtle. And I mean, I'm not like the world's expert on Star Fox 64, but I know this game pretty thoroughly. And I really couldn't tell any difference. So
well, whatever the differences are, apparently the developer thought they were substantial enough to warrant having like two separate scoreboards.
Yeah, that's really weird. I mean, but, you know, if the number of enemies change, then it would change what is the theoretical maximum score you could get, you know?
Of course.
So maybe that makes some sense. I just feel like if you're going to make two different versions of the game, maybe they could be more distinct than this, you know? Mm. But I don't know that you're necessarily meant to play through it a bunch of times on one mode and then play through it a bunch more on the other. I think it's maybe just pick the one that feels right to you and stick with it. So I'm just, for now, I guess I'm just going to stick with the 3DS mode. But hey, it's Star Fox 64, man. It's an awesome game. It is one of the best N64 games. It is easily, in my opinion, the best Star Fox game. And I think this is a really, really nice version of it. It's not perfect, but it's really nice. And the fact that I got it for, you know, a bunch of Club Nintendo coins rather than having to pay $39.99 when it first came out, it was a pretty easy decision for me. So I'm glad I finally got to play through it. It's just a good reminder that Star Fox 64 is hella awesome.
And it's perfectly suited for portable play. I mean, it lasts, 25 minutes, half an hour?
Yeah, you can play through the whole game in about half an hour. But, and I mean, that was a weird format when it came out. It feels even weirder now, frankly. You know, the fact that it's very arcadey, even though there's never been a Star Fox arcade game at all. But this is, it is very arcadey in the sense that you basically sit down, you can, you know, if you're good, you can play through the entire game in about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But it is very much structured to be played through multiple times, and there's a lot of levels that you'll never even see the first time through. And some of them are really hard to get to. You have to, like, fulfill
the one with the warp
very specific criteria to open up some of these levels.
I mean, I will say the first time I played this game, originally, when I got it, I was done in, like, 35 minutes. I'm like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right?
Where am I? But, yeah, like, there's the one we have to activate the warp zone gates to get over there. Like,
yeah.
That's a real – I mean, that's real strange because there's no indicate. You have to go off the path already and then do other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then some of the secret worlds have secret exits that take you into even more secret worlds.
Yeah.
So it's a game. It's a game full of secrets. They're really fun to discover. Some of them, even if you know what you need to do, they're still really challenging. And then it's a game that encourages you to play back through it and beat these, essentially get high scores on every level. Because when you get a certain number of hits, you get that medal. And the medals unlock something when you get all of them. So there is an incentive to really try to master all these different levels. And it's, to do that is a, it's a significant challenge, even though the game overall, I would say, is on the easy side. Especially just to get to the end of it is very easy. But to really, you know, to get all that stuff, it's, you know, it's the classic Nintendo formula. I mean, it's easy to get into, it's hard to master. And I think Star Fox 64 balances that really nicely. It's a very charming game. I mean, I love all the cheesy voice acting and the cheesy writing. It's making me pretty excited for the Wii U game and also extremely curious about just what is that? What in the world are they going to do? I mean, if they just made a whole bunch of Star Fox levels, I'd be pretty happy. If it was just a kind of a standard Star Fox game that was just fun to play, you know, some of these levels I feel like are almost too short. I mean, some of the levels are shocking. It's like less than 5 minutes to get through a whole level.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like there's probably a way to make these levels longer and keep them interesting and still maintain, you know, kind of a good momentum and a good pace. I'd be interested to see them try that.
I mean, you can
maybe just more of them. Maybe there's DLC. You know, there's a, you know, in this day and age, it's been so long since they really made a good, you know, modern Star Fox game. I feel like there's a lot of ways they could go with it, and we really still know almost nothing about this new one. So I'm really curious to see how they handle it. The other thing is, you know, looking at all these character models and all the little narrative scenes. I mean, there was never that much story in it. It was cool at the time because Nintendo was being like very aggressive about, you know, our games aren't using computer generated cutscenes. They're real time. So, you know, there would be little things they could do that would actually change the way the characters looked in these scenes because they're being rendered in real time. There's, you know, they're not stuck to,
because you couldn't put videos on the N64 cards.
Yeah, it was exactly. A limitation of the system is that they couldn't really compress FMV and make it look good. And so instead they found their own way, which was, you know, very innovative at the time and very important because a lot of games that came later really relied on that approach. So I mean it was a major innovation at the time, but there aren't that many scenes other than just, you know, the little pop-up heads of people talking. There's a lot of voice, which was super exciting at the time. But in terms of, like, actual cutscenes, there's not really that much in the game. And with the Wii U graphical power, I would love for them to go back and just do basically the Thunderbirds look to it. I mean, make them look
really
like
cool
puppets. Make them look like fuzzy puppets. I think that look would be perfect for Star Fox.
You mean the big statues that they had for the promotional material? The big fuzzy?
No, like the box art for the Super Nintendo
game. Yeah, those are real. Those things were real. Those pictures, those photographs, those were real statues that were made of those characters that had fur.
Badass.
And stuff.
Yes, that's. I think it would be awesome if they looked like that. I think it'd be incredible.
Yeah, it has had that little bit of a cheese factor. But kind of like they're in on
the joke. Yeah, yeah,
well, yeah. Because your enemy is Star Wolf, and he's got an eye patch. And he, I mean, yes, of course. Like, you can't.
Yeah, this game should not go like hardcore post-apocalyptic, super dark and gritty.
That would be a terrible decision. I'm going to 180
Space
on
Fox
it.
Marines. That's what I demand.
I want them to just give this to Project Aces and be done with it. Just let them make their own story. It'll be bonkers. It'll be great.
I think they've kind of tried that already.
No, that would do some other team inside Namco.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Star Fox 64 3D, it's nice to catch up with it a couple years later, and it definitely has me pretty excited about the new one, even though it's still a big mystery. So, listen, everybody, that's going to wrap up new business. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail.
now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. I was trying to think if I wanted to do something stupid in the intro, but I couldn't think of anything because I didn't plan ahead. So first up this week, John's with us this time.
I am.
Back to normal. Not the John that, when I said John's not here last week, claimed, well, I'm a John. You know who I mean. Everybody knew who I meant. Let's talk about that quote, John, the doctor. He wrote a script, and I haven't read it yet. So John, here we go. NWR's top 20 3DS games so far. For those of you with a new 3DS, gotta say them quick, like a hyphen. Perhaps you're saying, boy, only I knew which new games to get. We knew you'd ask that, so we cooked up a new list to tell you what they are, and Phoenix Wright isn't on it. Who knew? New fucking alliteration. I don't have time for this. We also have a contest, which we're not allowed to win because staff can't win contests. And I guess I'm going to say the word new 1,000 more times. Win a new Nintendo 3DS. Curve Digital, creators of cross-buy sensation Olly Olly, is teaming up with NWR to give one lucky winner a new Nintendo 3DS. All the rules are available on the website. Why did you put the website?
I don't know. We could go to it. Whatever.
So I could click and go there in case I didn't remember what the website was. All the rules are available on Nintendo World Report. Sorry, I couldn't shoehorn the word new into this one any further.
All right, and we have a review of Kirby and the Rainbow Curse for Wii U by Zach Miller. Zach wanted to get real, so he got Kirby. He also wanted to play a gorgeous HD game downscaled to his gamepad, and he got that too. I guess we can't all get what we want. We also have a review of Flipnote Studio 3D for 3DS by Andrew Brown. Want to create nifty 3D animations? Flipnote Studio 3D is for you. Of course, this one's a bit neutered, since they removed the network connectivity. You gotta protect the kids.
Well played.
But that won't stop Zach Miller from drawing anime boobs.
Well played getting that new in there.
Yeah, like that? It's a little bit of new. A little bit new for you.
Got a little newness on this very, very old game that's been out in Japan for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you wouldn't want to go on. You wouldn't want to share your stuff anyway.
No. Sharing is not caring.
That's right. Sharing is, well, in the case of our staff, probably harassment.
Mm-hmm.
All this and more harassment, I mean, seriously, you'll probably find it somewhere. It's available to you on the not-so-new website that we have, NintendoWorldReport.com.
We are back for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@NintendoWorldReport.com. Please email us just like these people. I'm excited to get into this one. This is an email that we've been holding on to for a couple weeks until John came back because I know he had a lot to say about it. I think we all do. And Guillaume is going to read that first email.
Sure. Tom writes, I would love to hear the 100% scans topic expanded into a listener mail segment. Most modern Nintendo games feature some element of achievement systems, or however you want to describe them, and I would be interested in hearing how the RFN crew feels about the subject. I have occasionally, inadvertently, ended up becoming my own worst enemy by imposing rules on myself that the developers never intended. Like, when playing modern Mario games, I sometimes don't want to advance to the next world until I fully explore the one that I'm on first, which can create a cycle where I end up replaying the same couple of levels over and over again instead of progressing through the game naturally. I used to get burned out on games by falling to this cycle, but now I deliberately try to focus on progressing through the main modes of games instead of getting hung up on getting 100% of the extras during my first playthrough. Some of these words were written in a way that you can't really say out loud.
100%ing.
Yeah,
100%ing. Okay. I guess it's doable, but...
So hopefully everyone remembers this, but a few weeks ago we talked about Metroid Prime Trilogy, John did, and brought it up and was talking about how that game... It in some ways encourages you to get 100% of the scans when you play through it, and yet
is that the episode where you told him that he's an idiot for
pretty much
caring?
Yeah,
I think you're paraphrasing there, buddy.
I think he's giving a 100% accurate description of what happened.
I wasn't playing the game right, Guillaume. That was actually the verbatim quote.
Oh,
I
see. Yeah.
I don't think like I said that either.
You were playing it like an idiot,
fair,
John.
There was. I need to correct myself, or some other people corrected for me. I was thinking at the time. I could not remember that getting 100. I remember that it acknowledged somehow that you got 100% of the scans, but I didn't remember it unlocking anything. And some people, I think it was on the NeoGAF thread, some people clarified that it does unlock some kind of art gallery.
Yeah, it does. Yep.
Which wouldn't never interest me, but hey, fair point. It's something. It's clearly the developers have structured the game in such a way that they are encouraging you and rewarding you for doing this. And in that case, they should make it. I mean, they should track it for you. I mean, they should, you know, I think, you know, one of the common complaints about that game is there are enemies in that game that if you don't scan them right away, you might never see them again.
Yeah.
And if you're deliberately trying to go through and get all the scans, that's crazy frustrating and that's bad design.
Yeah. You know? And you don't have any idea that that's the only time you're going to see that enemy. Like you don't really have any warning. And yes, it's something that, you know, it's kind of going above and beyond the way you might, I hate the word normally, but normally play the game. But I mean, but mm-hmm. that was really my, you know, what I was getting at was mm-hmm. they're kind of putting this carrot, you know, out there and saying, hey, you know, you may want to scan everything in the game, but we're going to make it a real pain in the ass to do so and make it incredibly obfuscated. Yeah.
And honestly, mea culpa, John, you were absolutely right to complain about that. I mean, that they should have done that better. And I know people have complained about it a long time. And my error was in thinking, I know that it's something, it's like a meta goal that people set for themselves. But my memory was that the developer doesn't really necessarily encourage you to do this because they don't really give you any incentive. It's just something that you can do. And, you know, again, I was wrong about that. So yeah, I think if they're going to give you a reward for doing it, they should make it not crazy arbitrary.
Whether or not the award's worth it is another thing entirely, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think the award's worth it, but that's my call to make. I mean, that's up to each individual. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's just more of a flaw in the way they implemented it. Now, a larger mm-hmm, question mm-hmm. is whether or not achievements are even. I don't know. I mean, I think achievements they evolved out of a way to extend the gameplay of a game. I think it's one of the many things that has been done over the years to try to extend the gameplay of a game. And it's valid, you know.
It was also a community feature, though. It was meant to let you compare what you've done in the game versus what other people. I think, you know, 100%ing a game and getting achievements in the game are two different things. I mean, there's a convergence point where a lot of times to get all the achievements – they ask you to get 100% of whatever's in the game. And a lot of times I feel that those are kind of the worst achievements. You know, they're the ones that drive people to play games in ways that maybe aren't fun, but at some point you just get sort of so obsessed with it that you feel like you have to do it and it becomes a chore. And that's unfortunate. I feel like there's a lot of games where you'd be better served designing achievements that just get the player to try to play the game in some creative and interesting ways and try different things out and shouldn't necessarily be about, you know, stepping into like every single corner and, you know, like uncovering every single little shaded thing on the map.
Yeah. I've seen various games, especially games with, you know, with online play, like first person shooters where there's certain achievements where it's just stupid. I mean, pretty much it forces people or steers them towards doing stuff like, doing like win trading and stuff like that, where, you know, you kind of hook up with somebody and you say, hey, if you beat me or if you do this, like kind of like something like some sort of like flag capture thing. Hey, you know, where you just sit there and swap flag captures back and forth until you hit this 10,000 flag capture ceiling, which is just ludicrous to begin with. That's poorly designed.
It goes back to a rant that Jeff Gerstmann had back when he was just a total achievement whore. And he talked about there'd be servers set up for some of these games where the person who owned the server would call it like, get your 10,000 headshot server here. And it would just be, he would just, the person who's running the game would just leave his Xbox running and just leave his character standing there. You could just headshot him as much as you wanted to get your headshots.
And that's basically why he stopped going after so many achievements.
Not until he did that one.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You know, I've heard him talk, you know, I've heard him say that, and he, I mean, at the time, I think Jeff was like in the top 10 in the world of of like yes. highest gamer scores on yes. Xbox 360. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he really is like one of the leading experts on this topic, or he was for a long time. He's not anymore. But I've heard him describe this a few times. And, you know, one of the reasons that he got out of this arms race for achievements was, you know, people were starting to hack games. Right. To get achievements. Yeah. People yeah. were setting up these ridiculous, like you guys have described, these kind of artificial conditions where you can just farm a bunch of them. And I think also there's an element of, at some point you just feel like I'm doing this to say that I've done it. I'm doing it for some kind of, you know, outside number score thing. And I'm not necessarily doing it because I'm having fun with it. Like at some point right, yeah. you get trapped in the routine of it, or you get trapped in the competitiveness of it, and you're playing things that you don't even find enjoyable just to, you know, just to enlarge your e-pain, to use a stupid old term for it. I think Nintendo's been fairly smart to not have this unified external system. I think there's pros and cons to it, but I think it, you know, after the fad has mostly burned out on the other systems, I feel like Nintendo looks smarter and smarter for mostly just making it intrinsically part of the games that they design it so that it makes sense.
And mostly for
not
knowing, figuring out how to do it themselves. I mean, to a certain extent, I feel fairly confident a certain extent, which is because they didn't have a unified network until fairly recently.
But yes, but yes, I mean the inadequacy of their system platform network technology forced them into a different solution. And I think ultimately their approach that they got kind of tunneled into has turned out to be probably the better way of doing it.
So I'm not going to give the drunk guy credit for not having a car accident because he was too drunk to open his car door. Like, I just, I'm not going to do that.
Can I just say, I've never cared about achievements. You know, like, I think I tried to platinum a game on PlayStation 3 once, and that was enough.
Why are you bragging?
I hate how Sony does that.
No, but
humble brag there.
I mean, it really is, it's to your credit that you don't give a shit about that stuff.
I prefer the other part of this email where he talks about, you know, trying to get everything 100% in the levels of a Mario game mm-hmm. before moving on. I'm kind of living through that right now with Kirby's Rainbow Curse, because there are these chests that you're supposed to get, and some of them are really, really tricky. And as I said, sometimes the game can be really frustrating. So Karen and I have been stuck in this, sometimes we're just, finally, like, we finished this level, we survived, but we missed this one thing. Do we move on, or do we go through this level one more time, try to get the chest that we missed, so that we never have to play this level again? And, that kind of mindset sometimes can really screw you over. Like, you're just like this one level that gives you trouble, and you keep playing it, and you don't find the one thing that you're missing. And eventually you just grow bored of the whole game. And I've kind of fallen prey to that, especially in the new Super Mario Brothers games, because they've all got these like 3 coins per level that you're supposed to find. And some of them are really, you know, kind of dicks, like how they're hidden. And I don't know, like sometimes I've been long stretches of time just not progressing at all.
So I mean, to that end of the question, though, I'm not necessarily sure that clicks into the 100%ing conversation necessarily.
No. Well, it's very different from the whole Metroid situation, because Metroid, it's literally you have to do this one thing over and over again,
the
through
entire
the whole
game. Yeah, you screw
and
it up one time,
like
you're
a dozen hours long at least. You
well,
know?
So I yeah, mean, it's for very me, punishing. I do, I don't do it, religiously, but I do attempt to get everything on my first playthrough of the 2D Mario games. And if I don't get something, it's not a big deal. But I will die repeatedly to try to get, you know, something that I can see. I know where it is. I'm just trying to get to it. But for the 3D games, especially because it's you go in, it's go out, you go out, you go in, you go out, you go in, you go out to get whatever item there is versus, you know, we've talked about this versus like the rare games where you could just keep going around and getting stuff. I'll go back into a level and get stars until I've got everything I can reasonably get and then progress on. And part of it's just because I know the level and like I feel like I can get through it more quickly and get to where I need to go. Part of it's because I like seeing how levels get changed up. Part of it's just because when I get to the next star check door, I want to go, I can blow through the next 4 doors and not open a level. And that, I don't even care. Let's go.
Well, I mean, 100%ing it varies from game to game. I mean, in Metroid Prime, it's one of the beefs I had with it was that they sort of they introduce the scans so that you can read more about the backstory of the game. And mm-hmm. I really like, you know, I want to read the backstory of Metroid Prime, but then it would be like if in something like Skyrim, if they had an achievement that was like, read every single one of the 10,000 pieces of text in this game. I'd be like, fuck that.
But John, yeah.
Is it in the Metroid Prime you feel like it's like an achievable goal? Like it's a small enough number? Or like, what is the motivation for you to get all of the scans? Is it because you just love reading them? Is it because you want the reward for doing it? Or you just want to see if you can even pull it off?
It's the fact that I want to read all of these different scans. So that's the thing. They interest me. So I want to read all the scans I can read anyway, so I might as well 100% them.
John, let me give you a piece of advice I give to children when I talk to them. Reading is for losers. I may have actually said that to one of my cousin's kids one time, that just to freak her out. But that's fine.
So John, let's say in the new Smash Brothers games, they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of trophies.
There's like 300.
I think over 1,000 between the two games.
Jesus Christ.
And the trophies are different from the 3DS game to the Wii U game. And the text for those trophies is often amazing. Like it's
terrible.
Fascinating, hilarious, bizarre. In that game, to me, they're on the par of the scans in Metroid, although obviously not like thematically unified in a single universe or anything, but they're worth reading, totally worth reading. Does that make you want to get every single trophy? Because I feel like
because I don't care as much.
Herculean task.
That's the thing. I don't care as much, and I can pretty much guarantee that. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, that the stuff that you would have to do to get them is completely outside of the actual main game. Like you would have to do, you have to jump through a bunch of hoops and like do this 20,000 times.
Trophy rush mode. I mean, that's what you have to jump through.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff that I wouldn't want to. If it's stuff, I mean, hoops. where I draw the line is if it takes me outside of something that I consider fun, I'm probably not going to do it unless it's
outside. That seems super reasonable.
But you know,
also outside the game itself.
Well,
because
exactly.
When you're playing Metroid Prime, you're scanning stuff. You're still like in the room where you're scanning it. Like it adds to the atmosphere. It adds something to the game. But you're also like you let go of the button from the scanning and you go on playing. Whereas in Smash Brothers, you have to exit. You have to stop what you're doing.
But you're still
go
in
to
the
trophies.
They could definitely be better integrated in Smash Brothers.
I mean,
absolutely.
Trophy Rush mode is a mode in the game. It is no different than any other mode in the game. You can find it through the same menu options. I don't think that's a great example.
No, but then you don't read right then and there every trophy description that you've just gained.
I do.
Who mentioned you have to exit. Trophy Rush is... There's lots of ways to get trophies other than Trophy Rush.
Well, I know, but they're all on the same screen.
I think maybe... Guillaume, if I understand what you're saying right, it'd be a better comparison would be like if you're playing Smash Run on 3DS, you know, you find trophies as you play through Smash Run.
Yep.
And when that happened, the game basically paused and said, hey, look at the trophy you just found. Here's a chance to read it. Of course, you can read it later if you want through the, to me, the menu should be like a reference. If you want to go back and read the stuff later, you can. But if they put so much work into modeling all these things and so much work into writing these texts for them, maybe they should just throw it in your face and be like, hey, dude, look at what you got. Okay, you don't want to read it now? Push a button and skip it.
But because you're playing
Smash,
or
even just put it at the end of a level. Like, okay, you've just finished a match, you got a new trophy, and at the end of the match, you can read the description right there and then.
Yeah, right. I
mean, that feels more like taking you out of the game than just having it on another menu option.
The way it's done right now, you have to basically sit down and intend to start Smash Brothers, not to actually play Smash Brothers, but to read like tens of thousands of words of text.
Okay.
One after the other, you know?
I've literally spent less time looking at trophies in the new games than I did back on Melee because they're deeper in the menus. It's just more of a pain in the ass to go even find them to look at them and read them, even though the models and the writing have never been better. And I do actually want to read it, but like, am I going to carve out a Smash Brothers session just to sit down for half an hour and read trophy descriptions? No.
Here's the thing.
I think integrating them would be bad. And that really gets to the heart of the matter, which is that this stuff isn't intrinsically good or bad. It really comes down to the individual presentation, the individual design of any given game. You can do it well, you can do it badly, and there aren't like hard and fast rules. It really has to be customized for whatever experience you're having.
But I think literally alerting you during gameplay or at the end of a Smash run when you're about to go into the actual gameplay is probably – I mean, that is literally taking you out of the gameplay. I mean
– okay, then do it at the end of the Smash run, James.
At the end of the Smash run is before the match.
Oh, then at the end of the match.
But then your friends are going to probably want to go start another match. I mean
– what do you mean your friends? Smash run is a single-player mode, James.
Fine. You'll be stopping –
and we know you have no friends.
It's a single-player mode. I'm not talking about in local multiplayer have trophies come up and interrupt what everybody's doing.
But then,
I'm saying
then,
when you're playing the game by yourself, that's the perfect time.
But then you still have to go back out.
To integrate these trophies.
I don't feel like this is – that the idea of having to go to a menu to read the text is really commensurate with the topic at hand, which is about doing a thing that you have to do repeatedly, successfully in gameplay at that moment in time. I feel like it's a completely different conversation. This would be like if you could only get the trophies by doing stuff. This is more an issue of experiencing the trophy after you have already acquired it.
But the problem I think with this topic, it's a little bit too broad, you know, because there's so many forms that these different achievements can take, and like we touched about the social aspect of it and the fact that achievements are shared with other people, but Nintendo also put their own achievements in, for instance, like the Street Pass games on the 3DS, and those aren't shared with anyone, but they still have the same kind of
accomplishments called?
Yeah, and they still have this the same kind of bad kind of do this one thing over and over again side to them, that's just garbage, right? And that makes so many achievements bad achievements. Like, okay, so you fight this guy, now do it 300 times. And it's exactly the same thing, and you get
a
ticket for
it. It's Avatar The Last Airbender achievements.
Yeah, well, and stuff like that is not creative to me. It's stupid.
It's a bad way to do it.
Yep.
But if we could get away from even the idea of structured achievements, I think there's also, you know, there's a long history going back way before these modern achievement tracking systems. They were really a way to try to formalize something that people have been doing since the beginning of video games, which is really creating your own achievements, you know, creating your own task. And some of them may just be something that's, you know, very difficult to do. It's like, you know, beating a game without, you know, like beating Zelda without ever picking up the sword was one of the first ones I ever heard of. And I thought, that's completely insane. I don't even know how you would do it. It doesn't seem like it would even be possible.
It's like the old life
but
counter.
But people find a way to
it's
do
like
it.
The old life
and it doesn't seem,
games.
It probably wouldn't be fun to me if I tried to do it, but somebody thinks it's fun. So they did it.
Yeah. I mean, speedrunning. I mean, people that speedrun games, I think they're nuts.
Yeah.
But
especially
they love it.
Like the thousands of times that they go through it before the, you know, what you see when you go watch speedrunning on Awesome Games Done Quick, that is the culmination of many years of grinding through the game in a way that I find incredibly tedious and want nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. But in the end, you get this amazing performance art.
Well, I mean, basically. I go back
more,
to like,
yeah, more power to them.
I go back to like
it's
the old,
impressive, yeah.
The old Nintendo Power contest where it was the send us your photograph of your 3-heart, 0 deaths Ocarina of Time run. I'm like, they're not getting any of those. And they got like 70 of them in a month. It's like,
sure. And I bet a lot of people started on it once Nintendo Power asked them to do it. Like, they wouldn't have ever even thought to try it, but they're like, hey, this sounds like a challenge. I want to go for it.
It's miserable. That's a miserable challenge, too.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to do it. But, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is knowing, you know, kind of paying attention to what you're doing and being deliberate about it and not doing something because you feel like you need to. Like, this is something that concerns me sometimes when I hear about people complaining about like a new Mario Kart game because the Grand Prix is so frustrating to try to get 3 stars on every trophy. And I try to tell them,
you
know,
for that?
If you're you don't really. Okay. I think the title screen changes. I mean, the game clearly incentivizes you just by tracking it alone. The fact that it has those stars, period, means that they've incentivized you in some way to do it. It may
eventually,
be a poor incentive, but it's there.
And also, you unlock the mirror mode in that way also.
Maybe you can unlock mirror mode just by getting gold trophies on everything. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think the stars are completely, they don't unlock anything playable, you know. But And you know, similar with the scans in Metroid. But I feel like, you know, people should never feel like they need to do that. I mean, if trying to do that stuff is causing you to not enjoy the game in any way, then please stop. Not because I told you to. Just listen to your body.
I'll kill you.
You know? Like, listen to yourself when you're playing these games. If you're getting really upset trying to achieve some meta goal, whether it's formalized in the game or maybe it's just something you've put upon yourself. You know, I want to play through Final Fantasy with four white mages and oh my god, it's so hard. It's like, well, yeah, because you probably shouldn't do it. I mean, the game's not really designed for you to be able to pull off that accomplishment. It is technically possible. You know, if you go through that process and you find that fulfilling and fun, then knock yourself out, dude. That's awesome. But if you're trying to do it just because you feel like you're supposed to, please don't. I mean, that's a bad way to go through life, doing things that you don't like because you think you're supposed to do them.
RFN is worried about you. Just so you know.
I'm worried and
I mean,
and
I'm not,
gonna,
but Johnny is apparently.
I'm gonna be a little confessional here and I wanna explain why sometimes on this topic I can come across as dismissive. It's a defense mechanism that I've built up over the years because when I was in probably my like early teens, maybe even like preteen years, there was a period of like 2 or 3 years where I had a very mild case of obsessive compulsive disorder. And I don't mean this in like the way that the internet throws around OCD just to describe people doing things that seem, you know, whatever. I mean, like I had like a tinge of the real deal. You know, and it was very mild and I basically grew out of it. I phased out of it in whatever way after a few years and I don't have to struggle with it anymore. But there are people who like actually deal with this their entire lives and it can be very debilitating. I mean, it's a mental illness. I mean, you can take medication for it. You can go to therapy. You can sort of train yourself to deal with it. And live a fruitful life despite it. But it's like, if you have a bad case of OCD, it's pretty serious business. And I've known people who really struggle with it. And I've had just enough exposure to it to be sympathetic and to understand a little bit about what they go through. And so for me, I know that those tendencies are inside of me somewhere, like bad, like to the point where I would do things that were completely pointless that I hated. And I couldn't make myself stop doing them. And that is a bad scene, okay? So even if you don't have the real OCD, even if you don't have even the mildest tinge of it like I did, I think recognizing in yourself, just paying attention to what you do, to your behaviors, to your, you know, your routines, if you find yourself doing something that you don't really get anything out of and you're just doing it compulsively just because you feel like you should or because you need to, but it, you know, stop and say, why am I doing this? If you're doing it because you're having fun, then please keep doing it. I mean, you know, I would never be one to tell you not to do something that you find entertaining in your video games. But if you feel like you owe it to Nintendo or you owe it to the universe or you owe it to other people to do things that are tedious and not fun and that really affect your enjoyment of the games that you play, then I think you should really consider for your own benefit playing your games in a different way. And I can't tell you exactly what that is because I think you have to experiment. It's different for every person. For me, over the years, I have, you know, somewhat out of necessity for playing the number of games and the variety of games that I have to because of, you know, writing for the website and then doing this podcast, but also in order to fight off my own tendencies, which are to bury very deep into something sometimes, or just, you know, I played through Chrono Trigger 15 times in the span of like 3 years. There's a little bit of OCD in that, okay? I mean, I was trying to like max out every statistic for every character that you could by collecting magic tabs that there were only 3 of in the entire game. And so I would play through the entire game just to pick up these 3 things. I didn't need anything else. I've already got 18 rainbow shells. I've got more than I could ever use. But I'm playing through the game to get that one speed tab that will get Magus, who's not even like he's an optional character, you know, to get his speed up to maximum. Or to get Isla up to level 99 so that her strength goes to star and she does 999 damage on every single enemy in the game.
Yeah, just like, to do it. Just to do
just,
it.
Just so you could straight up walk up to the end of the world monster, just punch him in the face.
And the thing is, when you finally do those things, I gotta tell you, they're not actually fulfilling. I mean, you can build up these grand Herculean tasks in your mind and feel like, well, I just have to keep working at it because when I get to the end of that road, it's going to all be worth it. And I can tell you, it won't be. So you better enjoy it as you're going. And thankfully, yeah, I was playing Chrono Trigger. I mean, it's a very enjoyable game. I mean, it's, you know, I don't necessarily regret that. I'm just trying to give a little tiny case study of this tendency, that I think a lot of people struggle with. But I mean, if you're not enjoying it and you're thinking that you're just kind of trying to put in the time so that there'll be some payoff at the end, that payoff is almost never worth it. So just play things in a way that is enjoyable in the moment. And you know, I don't even finish a lot of games anymore. Like, I've taken it really extreme on purpose because I'm like, you know, I'm going to play this game until I'm not having fun with it anymore. And then I'm going to put it down and I'll go play something else because there's too many games in the world.
See, I'm lucky that my way of expressing this is never about min-maxing characters or anything like that. It's always about, am I doing this the smartest way possible? Mm. And that's where I can get into a real dark place in like an Ogre Battle playthrough, where it's like, I'm going to make every character undead. Let's see what happens. Cause like in my mind, I'm like, I've never experimented with this. I don't know what this is like. Am I missing out here? Let's do something. And then, you know, I have dumped 35 hours into some experiment and concluded, nope, this was a dumb idea. It's not going to work. But for me, it's all very mental. So I'm allowed to go do other stuff while I'm not playing the game, whatever game it is. That just happens to be one that there's so many possibilities for trying things that I've, you know, either built or theoretically built every possible army configuration imaginable.
Well, and importantly, that is a game that you love. It's not Peter Jackson's King Kong the movie that you're playing just to get achievement.
The game, thank you. It's
one thing to play a game from your childhood that you love and you've lived with it for a very long time. You're looking for ways to continue getting something new out of it, you know, and that's basically
which really
what
is what speedrunners are doing, really. They love these games that they play.
Yes, right. Absolutely. Yes. And so that I'm glad you made that point because I don't want to suggest that all speedrunners are obsessive compulsives or that there's something wrong with them that, or that they need to, you know, seriously consider whether what they're doing is healthy.
Speedrunners get help.
There's nothing wrong with it in the right context. But what concerns me is when people play new games, like games that they really shouldn't have any attachment to. I mean, you know, you paid $50 for this game. That doesn't mean that you have to extract every possible ounce of content out of it. Enjoy it. Just try to enjoy it. And if you're playing it in such a way that's making it not enjoyable, then do something else with your time, you know? And that's all I'm trying to say is I'm just trying to ask people to be reflective and to make sure, because this is how people burn out on games. It's how people like walk away from video games is because they end up getting in these bad habits that spiral out of control and they get to the point where they just can't handle it anymore and they just have to walk away and they say, I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean,
you heard about this with like World of Warcraft, you know, like people would get into it so deep and get so addicted to it. And finally it would like affect their lives in a really bad way, or they would just start to question like, what am I doing with my life? You know, it can become unhealthy. And at some point you have to walk away from it. What I'm trying to encourage people is don't quit World of Warcraft. Just cut back on it. Just play it in such a way that's like it becomes compatible with your life and the other things that you want to do.
Yeah, but not every case can be that extreme, right?
Like,
game is going to be life destroying, but I think much, much smaller scale, yeah, like it is healthy to ask yourself, am I enjoying this right now, or am I just playing it just because I feel like I have to? And I do that with RPGs sometimes. I went through the trouble of getting the best ending in Shin Megami Tensei 4, and I felt like at the end, like, wow, that really wasn't worth it because it required doing stuff that really wasn't well designed, that really wasn't fun. But in other cases, I'm able to just step back and say, like, okay, I've been playing this for 40 hours. Like, what was it? Dragon Quest VI. I had been playing it for 50 hours and I saw the credits, and then there's an extra quest, and then it's just like, okay, no, I'm taking this card out of the DS and putting it away.
Good for
you. Time to do something else.
And there is sometimes some peer pressure in games. You know, I'll hear people say, oh, well, did you get all the Kong letters in every level of Tropical Freeze? And I'll say, no, hell no, no. And they'll say, oh man, you didn't even play that game. You don't even know. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I knew that stuff was in there, and I made the judgment call. I made the game time decision to walk away and play something else. And that was the best decision for me.
In some cases, though, I think that there's a lot of truth. That, like in Warland Shake It, I think you haven't really played the game unless you've done the coin and time requirements. Because they ask you to play the game in a completely different way.
Well, you haven't played the best part of the game. You know, so if somebody plays that game and they say, I just didn't like it, you know, I would say, did you try doing this stuff? Because you might find that that's when it hooks you, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So anyway,
but that's part of gameplay, though, right? That's not something –
Maybe it's a different conversation. It's absolutely different gameplay.
I think we should wrap this
up.
We've
expanded the borders of this conversation.
It's absolutely
immensely.
Yeah. I mean, this Let's could talk go about Amiibo. On and on.
We've manifest destinied this conversation topic.
This could
I
want
to talk
go,
about
this
gold
could
Mario,
go to Amiibo. This
gold
could go,
Mario Amiibos. And
this could go to Amiibo. Yes, because ultimately it's that I need to have all of them.
This has become about Mario exclusive.
You're not wrong.
I am going to call a German retailer and have them mail me a Shulk Amiibo because it is the only way I'm going to get it.
Yeah. Well. Anyway, let's not go there. But yet you're not wrong. But I think we've put enough material out there that a lot of people are going to respond to this in their own ways. And I'm really curious to see what people have to say about different aspects of this. And we can come back to this and talk about it from different angles, depending on what people are the most interested in. So I'd like to leave it here in unfinished, you know, indefinite, and hear from the listeners and get a sense of what part of this they find the most interesting. And maybe we'll come back to it after that. So please let us know, you know, send in an email. But for now, we're going to move on, and John has the next very short email.
And today in North America, Nintendo is finally releasing the Donkey Kong Country Trilogy on Wii U and the Donkey Kong Land Trilogy on 3DS. Did everyone else love these six games as much as I did?
That's from Leo.
Well, Leo, I don't know how much you love those games, so I can't answer this question. Next question.
Do people really love Donkey Kong Land? I mean, they're just kind of downgrade ports of Donkey Kong Country.
No. I haven't played it, but I do know that the first Donkey Kong Land is actually an original game.
It is an original game, yes.
Yeah. Really?
Yes. And it's apparently worth playing.
It is regarded as a good game, yes.
No shit. No. I always thought it was just a port.
It is not.
Like a
Game Boy port
of Donkey Kong.
Because the characters are different in them. Like, cause I think the very first game is like the big giant Kong is called like Kitty Kong or whatever. And then the other one in Trixie, I think.
I'm not so sure about
those
that.
Are the
no, I think, I think that, yeah, I think that Donkey Kong and, what's his name? Or the main characters.
Ralph,
but
Ralph
Diddy.
Kong.
But the levels
but,
are different.
But no, the levels are different, and you're in the city setting at some point. And it's stuff that's just not in the Super Nintendo game. I'm very excited to finally check that out.
Can I drop a pause here and go, what the fuck did Nintendo do that said, let's put out all six in one day?
There's no symbolism
that I can discern from it being February 26th is like...
No, I think it's just I don't know. Maybe they wanted to make a splash. I mean, people are talking about it. They definitely got some attention for doing it.
I saw the press release today.
Maybe it's as simple as that.
I thought like, oh, I'm still asleep. It's a good thing I'm off this week. Because I just got an email saying there's six Donkey Kong games came out in one day.
John, what are your thoughts on these games?
That's the thing. Donkey Kong, I've never been a huge Donkey Kong Country fan. I remember playing
the very first
one down on the Super NES. But beyond that, but it intrigues me that Donkey Kong Land, that's actually an original game. Yeah. Because I assumed very much, just like you did, Johnny, that it was just kind of like, another sort of like...
No, they're original. That's why they had different names.
Yeah.
That's why they had different names, guys.
But are 2 and 3 also original?
I believe they are, yes.
I think that they stick a little bit closer to the themes and the graphics, the various levels of their respective games. So
I remember like looking at them in Nintendo Power and thinking they just look like ports. Like, why would I want to play the same game again but now in black and white? I didn't really... I mean, it's portable, yes, but I didn't have a black and white Game Boy, so You know, I just, what wasn't a factor for me, I just kept thinking, why would they even do this? It's so weird. Mm. Especially Donkey Kong Country was all about technological superiority. It was like, this is the craziest looking graphics you've ever seen for Super Nintendo. Now we're going to put it on Game Boy. It's just such a weird thing to do.
Yeah.
Are
you telling me you've never played Killer Instinct on the Game Boy?
I have.
God, shame on you.
Oh.
There are some stage names that are borrowed from Donkey Kong Country 2, but they're different stages.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So they're all three original games. Holy crap. I wonder which one of them is the best then, because I'm probably not going to play all three.
All three of them are the best. You should go play all three.
But I can't speak for Country, so I've played all three of those games. I know 2 is widely regarded as the best. It certainly has
it's
the best
my
music.
Favorite.
I think it's pretty accepted that it does have the best soundtrack, at least. But I like 3. Now, 3 was the only one that I owned, so I played the most of it for sure. But I definitely played the first two when they came out quite a bit. I think 3 is my favorite and the best because it was, you know, certainly the most advanced. I mean, this game came out after the N64, so it's the one that probably the least people have played. Because I think a lot of people just sort of had moved on with life by the time DKC3 came out, but also has by far the best overworld. And the overworld was always kind of an interesting little thing. You know, in the first game, it was patterned after Super Mario World, basically, or Super Mario 3, but really kind of simple. You know, I mean, it was all done in the kind of weird CG claymation almost, style. But still, you know, you're just playing this little tiny version of Donkey Kong and you just kind of move from one node to the next. But in Donkey Kong Country 3, it's a free roaming overworld. You can walk, you walk to the different nodes, but there, sometimes you walk around things, you control the character directly, move them in any direction, and there are secret.
It's basically the forerunner to Xenoblade.
No. But there are secret things. There are secret places. It's more like Chrono Trigger, actually, because it is still like zoomed out. You have these little tiny versions of the characters, but you can move in any direction. And there are like secret places. There's secret caves. There's secret banana coins. There's like places you can go. And also, as you go through the game, you get different vehicles. Like you get a Sea-Doo, and then later on you get like this flying helicopter-y thing that let you travel to places on the map that you couldn't get to before. And you can even take them back to the first worlds and go find places there on the map that you couldn't get to before. And it's like, it's kind of a small part of the game, but it's just like that little bit of spice that makes it so much more interesting to me and really kind of fleshed out the world of that game. And I think it's so memorable and so few people, ever talk about DKC3. I think that alone makes it really worth playing.
So fun fact about Donkey Kong Land 3, I'd forgotten
Donkey Kong Land.
I'd forgotten this, which I believe is regarded as the best one. But in Japan, there is a color version of this game that came out later. That never came out here. So I was curious what they released in North America or what they released on the Virtual Console. Japan got the color one, and we got the crappy black and white.
Really?
Damn it!
My favorite of the Donkey Kong Country games is 2. I didn't like it when I rented it back in the day, and only when I got the VC version on the Wii, I finally made it past the boring pirate levels, which I hated, and I think the game gets much better after that. Like, I feel like the first world of that game is all wrong. Like, the pirate levels are kind of... they're not all that interesting. There's a lot of climbing. The levels are very vertical. And I feel like there's more, really obnoxiously placed enemies. And I think that they kind of fix that as you go through the game. I was floored. I made it through the game in maybe like 12 hours, found everything, and it was just one of those near flawless, platforming experiences.
I want to point out that between 94 and 96 and 99, excuse me, Rare made 7 Donkey Kong games. Because they made the 3 Super Nintendo ones, the 3 Game Boy ones, and 64. Yeah. That's insane.
They also later ported at least the first DKC to GBA.
Did they do that port?
I think they might have done all 3 of them.
Did they do the port?
But they definitely did the first one. Yeah, they did the port. Yeah, remember, Rare had their own, even after they got sold to Microsoft, they had their own internal Game Boy Advance team.
But
who did all of their GBA games, and they made a bunch. They made that Banjo-Kazooie game that nobody ever talks about or played.
Yep.
They did Mr. Pants.
Crunky's Revenge.
They did,
yeah, it's and it's Mr. Pants.
Saberwolf.
Yeah, yep. They did Saberwolf. They did. Yep. There was a Conker game. Oh, actually, Conker was for Game Boy Color.
It was, yes.
But and there was a Perfect Dark for Game Boy Color that's totally forgotten, lost the time. But yeah, Rare did a bunch of. They had their own handheld team back then, so they were always working in parallel.
That's nuts.
Rare was a prolific studio.
Seven.
Holy cow.
Seven Donkey Kong games in 5 years.
Sure.
That's,
but I mean,
that's
look
nuts.
At how many N64 games they were turning
that's
out.
Nuts.
I mean, no
yeah.
one else even came close. They made more Nintendo, they made more N64 games than Nintendo. Rare was just a factory. They're amazing. Just
yeah.
an amazing studio.
Good
that
thing
is now,
nothing bad has happened to them since.
Yeah, let's not. Let's just pretend that they went away.
How are the avatars doing?
2003. Let's just mm-hmm. pretend that they no longer exist.
Aww. They pretty much did.
yeah, you know there is that some of the original guys split off. They're making their own like independently developed Banjo-Kazooie spiritual
yep.
successor. That I'm quite curious about.
They
that.
Are. They are. Shoot, I'm trying what they're called now. They have a really stupid name, like Playtron
yeah,
or something
I don't know,
like that.
But I don't think that. I think it's going to be an Edge. Pretty soon, but I don't think as of today that they've actually revealed what it looks like or anything.
They have not,
but,
no.
Man, I love Banjo-Kazooie.
I mean, and they've
I would
they've
really
got
love
some,
for that to come
they've
back.
They've got some of the core talent on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's of course the problem of whatever happens when you don't own your license anymore, and that sucks to create something.
Whatever, Banjo-Kazooie are not like good characters.
I disagree, though.
I'm happy for them to make new characters. Whatever.
I mean, that's know? A hard that's an important part of the process that can be tricky. I mean, really,
yes, but I feel like these guys can make new characters that are still good.
Yeah, I mean, they were very much born of the whole '90s mascot platformer craze.
But
yeah,
you know what?
They made new characters in their sleep.
That's part of what they're trying.
They made a character out of a toilet. His name is Lago.
They did, and that's part of
Lago.
They did that.
His name is Lago.
When they did that, it was part of the joke about what they themselves had done. That was them looking in the mirror and going, "What have we done?"
Oh, absolutely. They're, very, very self-referential.
It's
for
beautiful.
Sure. They very self-aware.
It's beautiful. You know? I mean, it's
yeah.
Oh.
They made like a little pygmy witch
Playtronic.
Doctor dude
That's
who could
it.
Transform. He could transform into a washing machine.
Yeah, he can.
That is playable.
Why wouldn't you? No, you can transform into an ambulance. That's playable.
I guess he
transformed you into it.
Yeah.
Playtonic. Playtonic games is
gloriously
is the
stupid.
Company that they have founded.
We won't even talk about Conker. But anyway, Donkey Kong Country. I'm really glad it's out. It's cool. I like those games. I don't love them, but I like them. Okay. Last email for this week. James, can you read this one, please?
Ben from Detroit writes, "I've been pondering what Abraham Lincoln's appearance in codename Steam means to the greater Nintendo universe. Is Abe technically a Nintendo character now? Will Nintendo attempt to give insightful commentary on the United States' history of slavery from the perspective of the modern Japanese businessman? I am personally hoping we can see an Abraham Lincoln amiibo. If Fire Emblem amiibos are compatible with Codename Steam, I see no reason why an Abraham Lincoln amiibo shouldn't be compatible with the next Fire Emblem game. What are your thoughts?"
I wouldn't put anything past Nintendo for amiibos.
That would be the one amiibo I would own.
That is true.
Steampunk
yeah,
Abraham Lincoln
right.
amiibo? Jesus Christ.
I would put
He's
good money down for
with,
Abraham.
Conduit 3.
Yeah,
if
there
that
you go.
Comes out.
Genius.
Space Lincoln.
Bazinga.
Now it's got to happen.
Yeah, it has to happen.
God.
Yeah, I would put good money down on that.
I'd put good money down.
That I would break the seal for Abraham Lincoln amiibo.
Break the seal.
Oh my God!
I would definitely
do
that.
I think, you know, seriousness tended to probably feel a little uncomfortable making amiibo of real people. But Jesus,
hey, he's dead. He's long dead. He's not
that
even real anymore.
Gain his realness,
so,
John.
So they would feel uncomfortable making a toy of Abraham Lincoln, but they're perfectly fine putting him in a game where
John's
pilots a giant mech of himself.
That seal got broken already when they put Abraham Lincoln in space. I think it's a weird thing. It's something that would have been very common on the in like Super Famicom to just take like a random ass U.S. like this is Grover Cleveland in this Super Nintendo RPG that never came out of Japan. He's just here.
I can't believe you went to Grover Cleveland.
Jesus. Is that the one U.S. president that I never thought would be mentioned on this podcast for 800, Alex?
He's the only president to serve non-consecutive terms.
That's actually, you know what? That's part of the reason he came up.
It's amazing.
America.
It's kind of like...
The knowledge on this podcast just astounds me at times.
That's something that happened more frequently in a different era. It's not something that you see a lot of now using actual people.
Richard Nixon amiibo is what I want.
I mean...
Tricky dick.
Yeah, I mean...
He has a move to Smash called the Tricky Dick.
When you're going for a president as a punchline, there's this stretch of three presidents that are just regarded as old fat white guys with beards, and nobody can tell the difference between them and what they did. Those are the three you go for, because everyone's like, I know the name. Anyway, continue.
Like
Taft actually, no, because people know what Taft did.
He wasn't bearded, though. He was clean-shaven, I think. Mm.
Release their games as kind of like the same thing, but different covers, like Nintendogs.
There you go.
Harry Truman and Friends. Plus Cats.
Was like, yeah. James Polk and
Harry
Friends.
Harry Truman plus Cats, yes.
Oh, man. Ninkinity and go. Cats.
That's, I mean.
That's it. Honestly, I feel like. I think Guillaume, in all seriousness, like, makes a good point. If they're willing to put Abe Lincoln in their video game, why wouldn't they be willing to make an amiibo of him? It's not like it's any less tasteful.
I'm sure sitting on shelves between Mario and Yoshi. I mean, like, retailers might go, not interested. I'm going to pass.
I'm sure you can go to any truck stop in this fine country and find far more, far,
well,
far
I'm not
less
suggesting they
stuff
make
with
Abraham
Abe,
Lincoln
with
mud flaps,
with
you
Abe
asshole.
Lincoln on them than any than yeah. any amiibo.
I think like Abe Lincoln like standing in space armor with holding a laser gun is like that sells in a toy store to me. I feel like
retailers might just look
product.
At that and go, what the fuck.
In fact, there's probably already a toy exactly like that that just doesn't have an NFC chip in it.
Yeah,
it was probably for made, Abraham Lincoln so. Vampire Hunter, which is a movie
exactly.
that's real. If you've forgotten it,
yes, yes,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah, unfortunately.
Abe Lincoln,
but,
he's already gone mainstream, man.
Like Lincoln being in Codename Steam is great and hilarious. But what I'm really excited about is the fact that that game, it's not just like old presidents. It's like all these literary figures too. You know, like Tom Sawyer is a playable character in that game. I don't even remember all the other ones. I think
John
maybe
Henry.
Mr. Hyde from
John
Henry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's really
that,
cool.
That part
you know?
Of it, and, that aspect of it just reminds me uncomfortably of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen
that's,
movie.
That's the
totally.
Vibe I had playing the game. That made me feel icky.
But yeah, but you know, that was also a great comic book series before a terrible movie. So... It's not necessarily sure. a bad touch point, and considering that Codename Steam is very clearly patterned after, you know, Western comic books, I think it makes sense that they would go for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen vibe, because that was a very popular, highly regarded comic book. I've read it. It's not my favorite, but it's certainly interesting. So I think that's an aspect of the game that I'm really looking forward to seeing how they handle it. Maybe it just ends up being kind of goofy dialect opportunities, but I really kind of hope they go a little bit farther with it and make these, you know, make
Too
these into like real characters
dialect
who have their own have personalities and, you know, people, you know, like in Star Fox. I mean, at least give them that much personality. Make it someone who we can identify and, you know, I wouldn't it be great if like the next if Abe Lincoln becomes so popular that he ends up in the next Smash Brothers? Why not?
I don't know. It makes me think that I would want to see Intelligent Systems create an Advance Wars or Fire Emblem type game, but branch out with like different stories. I think we've seen enough dragons,
no dragons.
And people who find war to be fun, and perhaps like I don't know, like mix it up a little.
Napoleon
like,
II.
Keep...
Jeez.
Okay, maybe
well,
not,
I...
but. Yeah, I don't know, something more historical, historically grounded, or...
Yeah, but like, it would be fun, is the problem. Because, I mean, I play a lot of these games, I recognize that if you're trying to really represent the grind that is combat, it's going to wear on people. It's hard. It's hard to keep that fun and you know, quick moving. A lot of those games are, you just have to wait, and you are...
I mean, I think they could find a way to make it fun. Intelligent Systems is, you know, super talented at doing that. But I just don't think it would fit into the vibe that they would be going for. You know, I just don't see Intelligent Systems making like a really gritty, realistic historical strategy game.
Well, yeah. And clearly when they think of historical characters, they come up with something like Codename Steam. So,
right. Which is fine.
That's the direction they're going to take.
It's a style of game that they've never done before, and I'm really excited for it. I feel like, didn't everyone think that XCOM game a couple years ago was brilliant? I know I sure did. I won a lot of Game of the Year stuff, and to me, and I asked them about this at E3. I was like, well, I look at this and I see XCOM. Was that an inspiration? And they're like, we're big fans of that game, but we want to do our own thing. It's like, okay, yes. So yes. Yes, you played XCOM and you said, this is awesome, let's do this. And man, great. I want to play XCOM on my 3DS, except Japanese, except American, and except kind of British also. Yes, let's do it. Make it cel shaded. Let's go, baby.
It's a very confusing game.
Codename Steam. I'm so excited. All right. Well, more on that in a few weeks. It's coming up very soon. But for now, we are going to have to wrap up the show. Thank you, everyone, for emailing. We really appreciate it. We're getting these days more emails than we can fit on the show, which is, you know, I feel bad for the people who get left off. But at the same time, it's great for us because it means, you know, we can sort of sift through and find things that are appropriate for whatever week we're at. And we always go back and look at some of the older ones and try to catch up on one that we had to skip over if we get a chance to. So please don't be discouraged. If your email didn't get read, just write another one. Please stay involved. We really do appreciate hearing from everybody. The address, again, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And I really would love to get some feedback on the whole 100% thing. I'd love to hear what people think of that and what direction you'd like to see us take it. You know, when we approach it again sometime in the future. Want to give a couple of quick plugs. These things happened recently, and we had guests on the show and their own plugs, and I didn't want to step on them too much. But we recently had the 100th episode of Box Office Poison, which is a movie podcast that I'm on with other ex-RFN guys. You know, Carl and Mike Sklen, Stan Ferguson. Our friend John Rind, who's hilarious and really great. You know, I think a lot of people who listen to the show also listen to that one or have at least tried it at some time. If you haven't, please check it out. It's a similar tone, a similar vibe to RFN, except talking about movies. And we talk about all kinds of movies. I mean, just everything you can think of. And it's a lot of fun. We're good friends and we have a blast. So the 100th episode, it was great. We did the top five movies of the year that we were born, and all five of us were born in different years. So you get this wide span. It was really an interesting little exercise to go back and look at that stuff.
That's right.
So anyway, a lot of fun. And now good movies are starting to come out here pretty soon. I think we're out of the doldrums pretty soon. So, it'll be a good time to jump into it. So yeah, go check that out, over at, crosstalk.com with a W or on iTunes. Just search for Box Office Poison. And the other one is my other show, the one that I produce and edit and put together and host, is called Discover Music Project. I had not done one in a few months because of, being unemployed and moving and all the stress that went along with that. But, I recently brought it back. We did a new episode. My friend Taylor, we played Jenny Lewis, who, some of our Nintendo fans might know as the girl from The Wizard. She grew up to become a musician and a really, really great one. It's a fun episode. We play a lot of her music, get into her whole career, and there's more episodes coming up soon, including with some people from this website. I won't get into too much because I don't want to promise things before they're made, but a lot of irons in the fire there, and I'm hoping to release a lot of episodes of Discover Music Project in 2015. So please, that's also on Crosstalk. You can go over to the website or just subscribe on iTunes. And you'll get all the new ones. And there's a big, fun archive of back episodes as well that never get old. So please check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. Anyway, that's it. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Radio Freedom Today.
Bye. Later.